And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here!
No fear, no fear. You know, this weekend there was a lot of news that was going on, and we took it off anyway. I mean, we did a lot of work on the background on Freedom's Phoenix. We had a lot of nice family time and so on, but there's so much stuff going on that we have to get updated, and that's what we're going to do for you today. Stephen Lemon's come back to get us the update on what's going on in Ukraine and Gaza and so on, because that's what he does. So he's going to help us out with that. And we just got to get him for a half hour. Can't tax on a guy. Guy's, you know, getting back in form. You had some health issues. He's getting better. And nice for him to come back and give us what for. But I tell you, in the second hour, Marie Taylor. Now, what Marie was, she is an architect that graduated, a good friend of mine. His daughter graduated from the University of Arizona as an architect. But what happened was, she asked that I marry her. I mean, you know, do the ceremony. So I went through the, you know, got, you know, my card, you know, and I've married a few people. You know, it's been, that's been kind of cool, you know. But when I did that, her bridesmaid is Marie Taylor, that was an architect also that went to Palestine. Now, she was in, I can't remember if it was Gaza or in the Heights. Anyway, she was in Palestine there working to save some old buildings and remodel it. And that was another thing. I'm like, who do you get the permit from? Who allows you to save these historical buildings? And so she spent a lot of time there, came on the show, spent an hour telling us what her daily life is. You can't drive around anywhere without having an M16 pointed at you. You go to the stop, M16's pointed at you, or whatever they got. I think it was M16s. And we're going to get it caught up. She's not there anymore, but she's been keeping up with what's going on, and that's going to be an interesting young girl. You know, she's in her, you know, early mid-20s, spent months, if not over a year or more, in Palestine, and we're going to go ahead and see, and trying to save the buildings that they're bulldozing. So that's going to be interesting. Then in the third hour, we have Michael Belfore. You know, now, Michael, he's always gets an update on, you know, high tech. He has I just found out he has a newsletter. And I'm like, hey, how come I didn't know this before? You know, he wrote the book Rocketeers and all the private billionaire space guys, okay? You know, sits there and hangs out with Elon Musk and stuff. So we're going to go ahead. They just landed the first stage. It'll probably go up today. I sent it to staff to put up, you know, the first stage of Falcon 9. The first stage came and landed on the water. They finally got to see that, you know, without being a storm or something. So that's going to be cool. But let's go ahead and go to Stephen Lindman. Let me go ahead and, you know, give you the update on Stephen Lindman. Now, Stephen has been, you know, he's born in 34, so I mean, the guy's got some age on him, so he knows what's up. Now, he did 2 years in the Army. He's got an MBA from Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania. You know, he worked as a marketing research analyst. He was in the family business. But when he retires, when he started getting busy, and he's been writing for Freedom's Phoenix for, wow, since probably about the beginning, 06, 07, and he's gotten international awards, you know, for being a great journalist, and the guy is prolific. Now, he was writing 2 articles a day. Let's go ahead and check in with, you know, Stephen, how many articles a day are you doing now?
Oh, Ernie, it's great to be back on with you at my tender age of 80, and I must say I feel no different than I did the day before at age 79, but I'm moving in the right direction in terms of regaining my health. I would say I'm averaging maybe 1.5. I'm heading for 2. The last few days I've done 2, and what I do, Ernie, is I pace myself. If I can't do 2, I do 1. If I can do 2, fine. Rest is programmed into every day, but I must say, when I'm not writing and being on air, either on my own program or in wonderful programs like yours, it's the most boring time of the day for me. When I'm doing the stuff I really want to do, Ernie, that I love best, It is therapy for my body and my soul. I love it. I really love it.
Well, go ahead, and we got you for a short time. Just go ahead and give us an update on what's going on in the Ukraine. I mean, you're the guy that, you know, kind of gets past the crap. And, you know, was there attack on convoys by somebody doing something for something? I've got to the point to where I just don't care. I mean, I'm like, you know, seriously, let me, you know, do the movie a couple of years from now. Maybe I'll know what's up. You know, what's going on?
This was an attack that happened yesterday. A convoy of refugees was attacked. Whether it was deliberate, whether it was accidental, whether who did it, who knows? Nobody knows for certain.
Refugees from where to where?
Refugees from southeastern Ukraine fleeing the fighting. Fleeing the fighting. Well, the fighting is mainly from the Ukrainian forces. They're using F-16s, attack helicopters, artillery, using terror weapons like white phosphorus. I believe they're using chemical weapons. They're using all kinds of lawless and heavy weapons against Ukrainian citizens. And many, many thousands have been fleeing the fighting just to try to save themselves. Their homes are being destroyed. They're being killed. Dozens are being killed every day. And a convoy of refugees was leaving the southeastern Ukrainian area. It was hit by rockets or artillery or something or other. Many people died. Some were incinerated in their vehicles. It's unclear exactly what went on. But the odds are, Ernie, that the Ukrainian forces bore full responsibility for this.
Okay, but
firepower.
This is what's going on. I get the impression that the Ukrainian government has gotten support from the United States, and they want to have all kinds of whatever goodies that we can give them to, you know, let's go kill people. And they're trying to blame it on Russia. Russia's just sitting back going, you guys are, I mean, if we wanted to lay waste to somebody, we'd lay waste to them. But, you know, is Russians doing anything? And why are the Ukrainians attacking their own people? Because they got leanings towards Russia? I don't even understand the geopolitics on this. What's going on?
Well, if they attack their own people, it's a classic example of a false flag, Ernie, to blame on the other side. You know, I mean, there have been many, many false flags. America probably more guilty than any other country. But you launch an attack against somebody, and you blame it against the enemy that you want to vilify. That's the way a false flag works. In American history, it goes back to the 19th century. You know, remember the Maine and in the Havana Harbor, a false flag.
Well, what is the white trucks that was Putin was sending from Russia to the Ukrainian border? So what was up with that? What was going on?
Oh, this is humanitarian aid. I wrote, as far as what Russia is doing in Ukraine, Ernie, I wrote an article yesterday on the Freedom Phoenix website called Russia Waging Peace in Ukraine. That's exactly what Russia is doing. And America, for your listeners who don't know or may not recall, America overthrew a democratically elected Ukrainian government, Viktor Yanukovych, the president. Not a good president, not the kind of president I would want. Corrupt, lots of problems with that man. But Ukrainians democratically elected him in 2010. Washington orchestrated his overthrow, and they replaced him with a neo-Nazi-infested fascist government. These are Obama's new friends in Ukraine. They're vicious, they're ugly, they're lawless, they're xenophobic, they're anti-Semites. You can say one thing after another. And not only that, Ernie, they display their Nazi ideology openly with insignias and Sieg Heils in the streets.
Oh, this is... We need to stay up to date, but I'm glad Steven's doing it for us. And See, we don't have enough problems of our own. You know, it's like they're They're bucking for a mushroom cloud. More with Stephen Lemon.
Did you agree? Did you totally agree? I'll bet that you did. But did you read the agreement? There are 7 billion people on Earth, and there are over 6 billion active cell phone accounts right now. And every one of them came with an agreement. Billions have already agreed to allow entities that they do not know to use and abuse every feature of their mobile devices. Your computer activity is monitored and archived. Your car is tracked, and even your face is scanned. The current power structure grows more fearful every day of your desire for anonymity, independence, free association, freedom of movement, freedom of expression, and your freedom of thought. And entire categories of humans will be targeted. And if they, them, those that won't leave us alone determine that we are not within their control, then we will be categorized as out of control. FreedomsPhoenix.com will launch the next phase of the Levolution by the end of the summer of 2014. And if you have to tell your neighbors about it, then we did it wrong.
Oh, is it raining? We'll open up the window. Let me see. Yeah, we got a big storm going here. Hopefully we won't lose to... Whoa! Man, we got us a flood going on. So how you doing, Stephen?
Oh, I'm doing fine. Doing fine, Ernie. Maybe before too long, when I come on, I can do the full hour with you. I think it's best for me to stick with 30 minutes.
No, that's fine. Give them one more. Man, we got a big storm. Hopefully we won't lose connection. Okay, when we come back, the one thing that I'm really interested in is why. You know, I'm still not getting a clear, you know, why. It's like they want a big conflagration, but they want to blame it on somebody else. It doesn't matter. It's like they don't care. Yeah, so we started it, but we got to finish what we started or something. I mean, I'm not even sure what the attitude is. And what do the people there think?
Well, the people in America and the people in Ukraine, most of them don't have any idea what's going on. I mean, the Southeast Ukrainians suffering, they know what's going on. Bombs and shells are falling on them, so they know what's happening. I mean, they're outraged. They just want to get out of the line of fire. But the people in most of Ukraine's a pretty big country, and people in most of the country, they don't know what's going on. The media is controlled. The Ukrainian media is controlled, just like U.S. major media is controlled. You know, you get the standard propaganda line, so people know nothing unless they go online, read your website, read articles by people like me and others who try to tell the truth to people so they do know what's going on.
But how do you know? Where do you get your information? How do you sift through the crap?
Over the years that I've been writing, Ernie, I've discovered some great sources of information, reliable websites, and reliable people who write, who I trust. It took me some time to discover these people and these websites, going back about 10 years when I began, but these are my great sources, and I know the good people who really, really are reliable. Some of them are world figures, and they do their research, their due diligence, I do mine, and come up with the most scrupulous research to tell people the truth that we believe really are the truth. And again, in my case, Ernie, I'm independent. Nobody pays me anything, so nobody can say I'm in the tank for anybody. I'm not making a dime out of this. I'm just sitting here doing all this stuff because I think it's important to do.
I'm glad somebody's doing it that I trust, because, you know, we may have a different philosophy, but facts is facts, so we'll get into more facts when we come back. We'll be back in about...
I think we both believe in peace and not war, Ernie.
That's my first choice. All right, here we go.
You can put the Liberty Radio Network on the air in your area. Visit broadcast.lrn.fm to learn how. Broadcast.lrn.fm.
Rhodes, it's the Ernest Hancock Show. Where we're going, there aren't any roads.
Right back to Stephen Lindman. You know, let's go ahead and just, I don't want to miss, you know, any of the goodie here. Stephen, you know, I need to understand from your sources and so on. We talk off air just a little bit. I mean, why you? I mean, you know, I guess because nobody else is doing it. So my question is, why? Why are you why did we replace the democratically elected tyrant number whatever for a White House appointed tyrant number whatever to do what? What was the what?
Well, I think it all comes down to this, Ernie. America wants subservient pro-Western governments in place all over the world, wherever there is an independent sovereign state, not beholden to U.S. interests or Western interests, it targets the leadership of that country for regime change. The president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, was mostly favorable to the West, but not entirely. He was America and European countries thought he was agreeable to joining the EU under terms, Ernie, that no responsible leader would accept. In other words, everything benefiting the EU and nothing benefiting the Ukrainian people. Now, what kind of a responsible leader would accept a deal like that? Well, they were to-ing and fro-ing for a lot of months, and when it came down to push and shove time, Yanukovych backed off and either wanted more. He didn't outright reject the joining of the EU, but he delayed, he equivocated. It sounded like he was going to back out of the deal entirely, and that's when Washington targeted him for regime change, and the wheels went into motion, and it was ugly. I mean, the protests that they were orchestrated by Washington beginning last November in Kiev, that was all orchestrated in Washington, and one of the undersecretaries of state, Victoria Nuland, was over there in Ukraine working with the opposition forces to manufacture excuses to overthrow the government
during the Sochi Olympics.
I'm sorry?
That was during the Olympics in Russia.
Well, it was ongoing during the Russian Olympics in Sochi, absolutely. And I mean, it was ugly, ugly stuff, including many people being murdered, snipers from rooftops, fascist snipers from rooftops and windows, shooting police on the street. And the police, except for the first day or two, Ukrainian police showed remarkable restraint against all this stuff going. They were being attacked. Can you imagine Phoenix police or Chicago police standing back and letting themselves be attacked, being shot in the street? I mean, there'd be mayhem on the street. The police would fire back and start shooting these people. The Ukrainian police did not do that. Well, the coup happened. A fascist government was put in place. It's infested with neo-Nazis. America has control of Ukraine. But the real target, Ernie, is Russia, because Russia is a powerful country. It can match America's strength in nuclear weapons. And the last thing that sane people in America want is a war with Russia, where they can each lob nuclear weapons against each other with delivery systems that have pinpoint accuracy. I mean, they could knock out Phoenix in a heartbeat, or Chicago, or New York, or Washington, and we could knock out Moscow and St. Petersburg. I mean, that is madness to have a war like this. But there are crazy people in America who think that we need to get rid of Russia, even if it means going to war.
Well, what if they're not even in America? I get the impression these guys are sitting on their yacht, Cayman Island bunker, space station, seasteading platform, watching moving pieces on a board.
Oh, they are rich and powerful, and they have everything they want, absolutely. And the people in Congress, all they want to do is get reelected and get all the benefits they get, plus all the stuff they get on the side, plus all the corruption they're involved in, plus all the deals they got with the big corporations, including all the sweet jobs they get when they finally decide they want to retire with huge pensions that you and I could only dream of, Ernie. Huge pensions, depending on how long they've been in the Congress.
This is one thing I want to talk to you about before we run out of time. I've probably more so than any time in my life, I've been kind of, you know, it's really been an effort for me to maintain a positive attitude, you know, to like, you know, look for solutions, to offer alternatives to ignore as much as, you know, I can, you know, and still be informed to get ready for whatever. But I tell you, I've been kind of in a funk. I mean, there's something, you know, that's in the water, in the air, in the news, in the something. You know, I my family's doing pretty good. I got, you know, I mean, we've had some personal losses, but, you know, I'm like, there's something else going on. I feel it. I mean, are you getting that feeling? I mean, the atmosphere that you're operating in?
Well, I'm very concerned, Ernie, because of what's going on. We have a president I consider the worst this country has ever had. He calls himself a peace president, and yes, there hasn't been a day of peace. Not one day of peace throughout his entire tenure, 5.5 years. But, of course, there was not a day of peace during the Bush administration or the Clinton administration or the Reagan administration. So he simply replicates the worst of the previous presidencies. But we have this going on. We have multiple direct and proxy wars. Obama's proxy war on Syria, another war against Iraq. fact, America is supporting Israel's killing machine, the overthrow of a democratically elected government in Ukraine. I mean, what the heck else is going on? We have a police state apparatus at home where dissent is stifled. All kinds of stuff is going on. We have this, and the Congress goes along in lockstep, and rogue Western countries, the NATO allies, they're involved in all of this stuff. And ordinary people in America and around the world suffer so horrendously. I mean, it's just appalling. It seems to get worse and worse all the time, Ernie. It is really a disgusting thing. People ask me, don't you ever get discouraged with all this stuff going on? Don't you ever think that despite all the writing and media work you're doing, you're not making any difference? You know, you're doing all this stuff, you're spending lots of time, and you're not changing the world. And my answer is, well, I know that, but I just can't imagine doing anything else. Should I just sit back and do nothing and let these people get away with murder and everything else? I just can't do it, and I feel that this time of my life is my give-back life. I never became rich and famous, but I had a pretty decent life. I had benefits that most people around the world don't have, and I really felt that this time of my life, it began for me at age 70. This was my give-back time, and the way I want to spend the rest of it, Ernie, is giving back for the blessings that I have that I consider considerable, and that's the least I could do for my fellow human beings to try to do something to help them.
You know, if they went to Freedom's Phoenix and they just clicked on your name on any of the articles, then they would go to the all of your original articles and your commentary, your columns, and you could just see the love for humanity in there and, you know, just trying to chronicle the truth. And that's one thing that we try to do in Freedom's Phoenix. It's just chronicle the truth. It's like, look, man, you know, what's the truth? Who's truth? I go, you know, let me tell you what truth is. The first thing is, let me tell you what truth is. Not lies. I mean, everybody has their perspective, but let me tell you what the truth is. It's not lying. And Stephen Ledman doesn't lie. You know, here's the perspective that he has and why he has it. But I'm glad that you're doing this just for the chronicling. So hopefully in the future, we don't keep replicating this, keep allowing this to happen. And it is getting more difficult. This regime change, you know, and who's changing and whatever. I go, you know, first, why we even got a regime, which is government, and why do we have somebody that can change it other than the people that are there? They just cast it off in their minds. So that's what I think, where I think the real revolution is just us casting off all of these, you know, like football teams that we're supporting wearing jerseys for, you know, I break with thee. So this whole thing in Russia, we'll get, you know, go into the break in the archive. You know, Stephen and I will continue a little bit until he, you know, he has to go. We got to, you know, maintain his health because, you know, we don't want to lose him as a resource. But there's something bigger going on. There's something bigger. And it's humanity versus, I don't know, they, them, those that want to enslave us and make us livestock. Stephen Ledman on Freedom's Phoenix. Been one of our prize columnists for a long time. Then he goes and wins stuff. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Ernie.
We'll let you rest a little bit. If we just do the half hour thing, we just have you on more often. Hell, we'll put it on every week while the planet melts down. Donna, go ahead and do that, will you, Donna? Go ahead and just get them towards the middle end of next week or something. Just keep them on once a week. We'll do a half hour thing. That won't tax them too much.
Donna, the only day that's bad for me is Fridays, at least for the next 6 weeks. I have weekly treatments at Northwestern Memorial Hospital, and they run for a good number of hours. So Friday is my only real bad day.
Okay. She get that? Okay. She'll work it out. There's always been bad news. I mean, you know, but my optimism always came from that it was news that people were assimilating, especially the younger people. The older people, they're just looking for what team to root for. And so but the younger people, they have been, so yeah, I get it. Government's bad, you know. So I'm going, okay, at least they're learning something. Well, after you get that, how many times do you got to learn it? Then what? Then there's the instigating of problems. And you could see it in this Missouri Ferguson thing is that, you know, they bring in their MRAPs and all their material and their sonic. I mean, they wanted to put the police state on display. And the people were just, you know, I thought it was awesome. You know, they put their hands up, don't shoot. So, you know, it's just, so they're like, damn it, we need somebody to shoot at and give us a reason to shoot. Let's go shoot. And I'm just... There's going to be a beginning of, you know, finally the people are just going to go, I break with you know, all this stuff. I mean, this police state. I used to always say, you know, can we hurry up and get to a police state so we can leave? Well, I think we're getting there, you know, and we might want to leave.
Ernie, one of my earlier articles, five, six, 7 years ago, I wrote an article called Police State America, and I was talking on a federal level mostly. I mean, I just documented a chapter and verse. I mean, we have a police state here. You see the stuff going on in Ferguson. I mean, it goes on everywhere. It goes on in Chicago. It goes on anywhere. I mean, you challenge the cops in a city, man alive, I mean, they can shoot you dead in the street. There's nothing you can do about it. And go up against the federal government. I mean, they can lock you in a prison, throw the key away, and leave you there forever.
Yeah, I'm, you know, a lot of people wonder how I get away with, you know, all the stuff that we're still, and we got a bunch more stuff, you know, coming up. And I got some cases I'm working with Mark Victor on, you know, criminal defense attorney I work with. You know, he just did a presentation at Doug Casey event here this last spring, and they just sent out an email. Their most popular video ever was him talking about the police state. He goes, no, let me tell you how bad. I'm on the front lines here. Let me tell you the kind of crap I'm dealing with. You know, this thing in Ferguson, they go, they beat the crap out of a guy. It was a wrongful arrest or wrong guy or something, and they charged him with destruction of government property or something because he bled on the officers that beat him.
Oh, Jesus.
Did you hear that one?
No, I didn't hear
that. Oh, no, that's good, that's good. I mean, this is how bad it is. You know, yeah, you stained my uniform after I beat the crap out of you. Sorry I was the wrong guy, but, you know, you're guilty of bleeding on me. I mean, wow.
You put on a cop's uniform, Ernie, you can get away with cold-blooded murder. It pretty much happens. I mean, Ferguson was one example of what goes on across the country in big cities and small towns, and the cops literally get away with murder or bludgeoning people in the street. You know, people of color, mostly blacks, but Latinos also. I mean, they just get away with anything.
I got a call last night. I haven't even... We got to come back. I got a call last night from a woman here in Phoenix because she found me through Cop Block, you know, here in Arizona. And she wants me to help her with a policeman killed her son. I haven't even called her back yet, you know, so I got to deal with that. Hey, I got to let you go, man, if we don't go into this next segment.
Okay, Ernie, I'll let you go. We'll talk soon.
Next week. Bye.
Okay. Thanks, Ernie. Bye.
For Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock. To be a part of the show, call 602-264-2800.
We'll just have Stephen come back on, you know, a half hour every week. It probably won't tax him too much. He had, I don't even know what it was. Don't care. I mean, he had, you know, some procedure. I mean, it's always when you're 80, it's a procedure. And he goes in and infection. I mean, he was out for a couple months. You know, Pal was asking about him, you know, a senior editor, Pal Gamble. And he goes, hey, what happened to Steven? You know, didn't he say he was going into? I go, yeah, we should be pinging and checking, you know, seeing what's up. And finally, you know, Donna got hold of him and kind of found out what was happening. He's recovering. But, you know, for him, I just know it was driving him nuts. You know, being there as all the everything heating up all over the planet doing this stuff. Ah. You look at what was happening in Ferguson. And it's just indicative of, you know, the methodology that they would use to try and instigate a thing. See, the thing that's different about America is the individualism of individuals is such that it's I don't know how it plays out what they're trying to do. Can they just get a whole country to do? Well, a lot of these countries are the size of our states, you know, but America, one, is large. You know, it is fairly populous, you know, but it's different. Every state's different. Every community's different. Every part of communities, and it's like that around the world. But, you know, here in America, they want to homogenize you into one big, you know, America. That's why they can't have the flag big enough at every sporting event, you know. This is NFL's coming. NFL's coming. You know, we're going to have the, you know, big giant Super Bowl here in Phoenix, Glendale, right, you know, within, I don't know, like 10 miles from me, you know. And what do? Stand up against Empire, sometimes you just got to sit down. You know, so they do the Star Spangled whatever, you know, proud to be in market. You know, you just sit down. Will they? Will one person? I don't know. You know, probably. But, you know, what are they, them, those worried about? You know, a significant number of people. You know, they'll do whatever they can and say and guilt and bring in Boy Scouts and whatever the hell they got to do to try and make sure you stand up. But even them making the attempt, everybody's going to notice. Now, we'll be buttheads about it. We'll do some kind of something, you know, because we're creative. But, you know, stand against empire, sometimes you just got to sit down. And an international thing like that, that would be huge. You know, who would do that? You know, it would be interesting to see what celebrities and, you know, what who wouldn't sit down. Now, you knew that was the thing. You knew everybody expected you to pay money to this charity or get ice water poured on you. You know, what kind of fad is that? You know, my son out there with the kids, you know, he's laying down because his friends did whatever. Everybody's pouring ice buckets of ice water. I think it was Lou Gehrig's disease, either get the money or get ice poured on you. So everybody, like, forgot what the whole point was and getting ice poured on them. So it's, you know, whatever. It's all this hurting thing. We're going into another phase. What role will we play? You know, at some point, you know, you got to start taking care of home business. So Donna and I, in the last week or so, now since our 30th wedding anniversary, a week ago yesterday. And this last weekend, we took the weekend off. So that was good to catch up with Steven because, you know, we just went to a local resort here. It has kind of a water park thing and had the grandkids come over Saturday afternoon and kind of ate this co and ordering, you know, poolside service of where's my hamburger. And, you know, I had a good time and, you know, spent a little bit of money. I mean, not $1 billion, but it was cheaper than going to Hawaii. But we had a good time. So we just kind of let it flow, man. You know, doing the, you know, flinging out the, you know, the $10 bills. But the... You know, so we had a good time, you know, this weekend, and then Sunday we came back, yesterday's grandkid day, you know, or my daughter went back to visit in Pennsylvania and had my son-in-law's sister got married, so they went to that. Little Elin was, you know, the flower girl, you know, having a good time with that, shared that with her cousin, Heather, and it's just, you know, family. Got to see Grandma Krutt, my wife's Donna's grandmother, so it's great-great-grandmother to the little kids. Five generations of women. Five generations. These are the things that are important, and these are the first things that go away when you get into a civil war, when you get into an occupation, when you get into a regime change, when you get into, you know, and I can't even imagine what it's like. People think, hey, look, we just want to flee. We're just going to go over here, and you're getting straight for the F-16s. So there's evil in the world, and it's never really, you know, individuals are just bullies. There was a, wow, that'd be a good thing for us to do. There was a 1980-81 Oscar-winning short documentary called Toward Liberty, Carl Hess Story. You know, Carl Hess, Toward Liberty. And what it was about was Carl Hess was the mouth, the writer to Barry Goldwater in the 64 presidential campaign. And later on, become a libertarian hero, you know, help, you know, the founding of the Libertarian Party and, you know, promoting that and coming up with a lot of leadership for that and a lot of examples. And one time what started it, you know, a bunch of anarchists, you know, made this film. Well, they didn't really realize they were making a libertarian film. They were more anarchists. So you see, even just Goldwater conservatives against the government. Now, he's not against the government. He's against government, you know. So a lot of the anarchists, they say they're anarchists, but what they really want is social anarchy of redistribution of whatever they want. And as time went on, I don't think they really understood what they were saying or the impact that this film had. And it's just, it's awesome. But I've talked to the filmmakers, and they're like wanting to suppress their own film or something. It's just weird. And because they were, when YouTube first started, I put this up because, all right, I'll tell you the story. It's 2004. I'm running against John McCain for U.S. Senate. The senior editor of the Arizona Republic, the editorial page editor, he calls me, name's Ken Western, and he says, Ernie, you know, when I was in college, I remember Carl Hess, this Oscar-winning short on, you know, talking about libertarianism and everything. It was very impactful, great, wonderful. You know anything about it? Never heard of it. So I put out an email to the, you know, the boys and the girls, and, you know, and I, you know, a lot of the, in the movement and so on, back when it was, you know, you had an email list of, and I sent it out, and Lou Rockwell got back to me, and he said, "Hey, Ernie, I know, you know, Carl Hess's son, Carl Hess Jr., I think it was, Jr., and he goes, he has copies of that film. Well, he sent me a VHS of it. And I took, you know, the Pinnacle Dazzle, whatever it is, you know, you can convert video into digital." And I'm like, "Woohoo, look what I learned." And it took a while, you know, me figure that out. So we did that, and then we took it, and we put it online. Well, later, when this is, it was a year or two later when, you know, YouTube started really getting going. That was one of the first things I put up. Boom. It hit, you know, YouTube, and it started going stupid. Boom, I get a call from one of the filmmakers. "Ah, you can't, copyright violated, copyright, and can't take it down, copyright." You know, and people kept putting it up, and you can still see pieces of it, and they're really adamant about getting it down. And I go, "Why? You know, hell, I'll pimp it. You want to sell it? You want to go up, you want to buy, you know, sell copies of it? You know, I'll make DVD, we'll do whatever, let's do it, man. Where can we get it?" Can't. It's like they're trying to suppress it. They're using their ownership to keep this out. Toward Liberty, Carl Hess. Oscar-winning short documentary they did while they were in film school. I think they were French, you know, so they were socialist French. Okay, and it was at Boston or something, as a university. And I think what really had more to do with the film and the flavor of it and being as students, they didn't really understand what they were doing, was the professor. So there's a story behind this movie that we should do. The more I keep getting pieces of it. And I can see that what Carl was saying at the time has a lot to do with what's going on now. Because when you look at Hitler, you know, on a neighborhood stance, he's just a bully. Quit thinking this large collection. You nip it in the bud on a local level. These guys never rise to this kind of power. And the reason they do is because you give them positions of power to take over. Bad guys always seek it.
Uncovering the secrets and exposing the lies. That's what the readers of FreedomsPhoenix.com get every day. FreedomsPhoenix.com constantly providing the information, the real news about government policies, and the real relationship we all have with the coercive government. The real condition of the economy, innovations in technology, breakthroughs in energy, health, and computer science. Learn the truth well before it's admitted to in the lamestream media. The corporate media, nothing more than distributors of government propaganda. But now there's an alternative. FreedomsPhoenix.com. Constant news updates on the issues that affect your life in the most important ways. With liberty and property under constant attack, FreedomsPhoenix.com provides the understanding behind the propaganda, and it encourages the participation of its readers. Go to FreedomsPhoenix.com. That's Freedoms with an S, Phoenix.com. FreedomsPhoenix.com. The revolution between the ears has already happened.
While our satellite channel is free to listen to, it's not free for us. You can help us cover our satellite costs with the chip-in on the right side of the page at lrn.fm.
Freedom is the answer. What's the question?
I want to break free.
You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
I want to break free.
Well, the streets are flooded, but at least the rain isn't sideways. Okay. Man, we need to go check some trees and chickens and stuff. This is, yeah, we got hit, man. Bam. Okay. The Toward Liberty, Toward Liberty, Carl Hess, the point of that was bullies at a local level, you know, are easily seen, recognized, and often even dealt with. Especially if you're not looking for somebody else to do it. If you have a position of power, a shiny badge for him to get, well, that's the first thing they get. Some kind of legitimacy, credibility, get a bunch of other thugs going around, brown shirts of we rule the village, and as social order breaks down, they you know, will keep breaking out into more. They know the drill. You know, a little show of force, you know, nobody stops them, nobody stands up to them, they garner more support and, you know, thuggery and people and gangs and kind of, and we rule you now. The only way that's not done is where, and this is one thing that Bill Buport always did. Yeah, just get Bill on. Go ahead and, I want to, huh? Thursday. 2 hours Thursday. Okay, I already knew that. Yep, go. Because I talked to him about one of the things that he looks for geography. He goes, people that aren't conquered, they always head for the hills. It's run for the hills, run for the hills. Why? Why do you go to the hills? You know, what's in the hills? Defensive positions. Riflemen in the hills of never get conquered. As a warrior, he's glad to call himself a warrior. Now he's doing, his mercenary tour Afghanistan kind of thing, and he's doing in the army kind of special whatever. He didn't like talking about it. But the point is that he understands why. He does 5 presentations at this last year's Pork Fest. And, a couple of them are just irregular warfare. And let's talk about the philosophy of this and what's going to happen that. And the most interesting man in Liberty in this picture is him and his, tuxedo 007 thing. He's just having some fun with it. And Boston, the week after I was spending some time with Boston Tea Party, I'm going, look at all his paraphernalia, man. You got to call and give him crap, come on. So I'm having fun with that. But he's really doing this to bring attention to a lot of the things that he thinks needs to be done. We need to be our own little warriors. Because if you're not, in your community or whatever, somebody else will. They'll tell you what it is, how it's going to be. And they don't go to the community and say, hey, it's too much work. We're not incorporating that one. We're going over here. We'll go over here. We're not going in them their hills. Why? Because people that are able, just riflemen, that's why this Appleseed thing, rifle, they do a lot of 1776 history and, a lot of how a few riflemen were able to defend off the British Empire, blah, blah, blah. So this is the kind of stuff that, is of interest to me because I can see where it comes into play. But when you got, attack helicopters, that kind of goes out the window unless you got some Stinger missiles supplied by the CIA to the Mujahideen, and then all of a sudden they're Osama bin Laden taking down towers and stuff. I mean, it just never stops. But meddling here, all of a sudden, is 10, 15, 20, 30 years later, it blows back on you. This is the one concept that I thought Dr. Paul, did a great service to humanity by bringing it up. It's called blowback. But it's like intended. We have to go local. I mean, it's going to be local. It's going to be not, we don't have a bully here. Well, he's over there. Well, that's over there. Those guys over there should, take care of business, And if they see it as a threat to us, maybe as an individual, I may decide to go help out over there and that there's not a bully, on my borders, so I don't have to worry about the bully. But it's bullies. And bullies always seek more power. And we keep giving it to them. We get all the pomp and circumstance, we have all the buntings, the big red swastika or red, white, and blue, version of patriot nationalism, kind of stand on the sideline parade without a smile on your face, waving the flag, kind of stuff. I see it happening. And it's going to happen Super Bowl. Here we go. I mean, what obligation do we have to do anything other than ignore them? Here's good timing for you. I find out that we have Roku. Now, we went and I just wanted to try it because a friend of mine was just all over it. You should try and kind of doing, okay, fine, I get more stuff, and I like it. I got some of this stuff. I'll get, whatever service for $7 a month, and all of a sudden I get a lot of the series that I didn't get to watch, and I get to watch them all without commercial. I vote that. I go, hey, and I don't even have to pay for it. I just subscribe to Kevin. Done. I go, Donna, go ahead and cancel the satellite. Well, she calls, and they go, well, we're going to cut back this, and, it's only half of this and a third of that, and we didn't have any premium channels. Premium, I mean, just a base package of Discovery Channel, Watch Gold Rush, okay? Deadliest Cats, that's the only really thing on there gave a crap about. Network stuff, like maybe Castle or, Modern Family or something like that you can get later. If you wait 6 months, you can get it on cable anyway. Or if you pay Hulu, you can get it earlier. I don't know, don't care that much. So that's what the internet's for. So what happened was, all of a sudden, they convinced Donna to keep the satellite. So a year goes by or less, or about a year, I guess. And I check and I go, how much is the $100? $100 a month to keep the satellite to piss me off. I mean, you're just pissing me off. $100. We got a contract? No, it's just extended. Gave me a deal. I go, we're done. Done. Right in the middle of Shark Week. But what happened? We had it turned off on, Thursday, Friday. So we went, to a resort here for the weekend for our 30th, you know, kind of just having fun. So we go there, and we were Shark Week'd up, man. Got the last couple that we ended Shark Week at the end, and time to check out, and we're done with Shark Week. Okay? Good. I'm stressed out, man. You know, heck, I got to do my open water check dive this weekend. You know, do that hell in a lake, and I'm worried, you know. But I'm just going, this is, damn. I grew up in Florida. I used to go out into the Keys and swim around with sharks. Look, there's a shark and barracuda and shark. And, you know, you don't care. And you're 13, you see Jaws, and all of a sudden you care again, you know. So my thing was is that it was a lot of stress I didn't need. But I was more interested in the tech. Now they're, you know, different kind of cages, you know, they're tagging sharks with, you know, things that then they have submarines follow them around and get to see, you know, what they do, how they're hunting, tracking them. And you know, I'm going, ooh, this is cool tech. Next year or two, this is going to be cool. And I'll subscribe to that and I'll pay my, you know, $19.83 package or whatever. Watch it online. I am so sick of the programming. So we turned it off. Done. We got television. All of a sudden, what we do? We start selecting more DVDs, you know, for the grandkids, you know, if they want to do something, they're going to take a nap or whatever. And we got, oh, watch The Incredibles. It's called movies. I remember that. So it will be fine. But I'm really wanting to get this out of our life. You know, just start the programming, the push it. Because I never even hardly go check who watches CNN or Fox or MSNBC or Fox anymore. It's all propaganda. I don't care if it's even, they're not as bad as the other program. It's still BS. It's flag waving us versus them kind of. Where's the humanity? Where's the humanity channel? You know, that doesn't have some social agenda that they're wanting to, you know, do anyway. Yeah, it's bad. It's bad. So you should put us in charge and we'll rule you better. You know, I'm not sure what, you know, direction we're going. We're just increasing the capacity of Freedom's Phoenix behind the scenes. We're working hard. There's, you know, some new talent and different staff, and we're changing to start getting it ready for the next phase. You know, we've been working on it. You hear the commercial that we're doing. Look, if we got to tell you about it, we did it wrong. We launched on the funding center. Go to the funding, Freedom's Phoenix Funding Center. And we just launched it in last week, Friday, the Tragedy and Hope thing. It's just starting to get some buzz. You know, starting to get, you know, hundreds of dollars. I mean, it's starting to, you know, people are starting to donate. A lot of it you don't see because it's just straight Bitcoin. So you don't even see, you know, it up there until they update it every few days. And, you know, hey, I got some more money. But that is going to be a really good thing. Can Bitcoin be what we needed to be able to just disappear? Just in time for our disappearance. Let there be dark. Can that be done? It's going to be something like that. It's going to be squirrel, you know, from out of the freaking blue. All of a sudden, humanity got to just go off grid. Go, you know, is there somewhere you can move? Is there some place, some community you can be? You know, that's one thing. Wednesday, we have Karen Johnson, Senator Karen Johnson, up in Navajo County, northeastern Arizona, Sholo, Springerville area. Their, you know, constitutional county thing. And in 16, looks like Sheriff Mack is going to run for sheriff there. That's what they're really pumping for that. So she's going to come on and talk about all the stuff that's going on in northeastern Arizona. They're trying to, you know, fend themselves off. On the same day, we're going to have Rick Johnson, a good friend that lives up in Washington State near the border. They have a community up there, and there's some land going up for sale there. We're going to talk about that. You know, this is happening. This stuff that we're all talking about, the whatever the heck they call it, America, you know, redoing. Well, they're redoing, and we're going to talk about the people doing it. Marie?
Hey.
Hello. This will be very interesting. You got some interesting stuff for me?
You know, I really hope so. I don't know. I don't know the questions you're going to ask me yet.
Well, the experience. I mean, now that we can say who you are, you know, doesn't hurt. But the Donna, go ahead and make sure you link in the second hour of the previous show that we did. Go ahead and put that in there so they can go back to that. When did you leave Palestine? How long have you been back? And we'll start with that. When did you leave?
It was 1 year ago in April.
Okay, so last April. Mm-hmm. So we had you on when?
2012, I think, around the cast-led movement.
Go ahead and help me out with what cast-led is. I saw on your thing here, you're talking about cast-led was going on, whatever the hell that means. Okay, and then... we'll talk about it on air, but go ahead. And so it was April of 13 that we had you on, and then it seemed...
So April of 13 is when I left there. I don't know. We talked before that, I think in the winter times. In 2012.
Okay, so how long were you there from when to when?
I was there from July 2011 until April 2013.
July 11, April 13. Long enough. Okay. Wow. This is, I don't even, I want to save your shocking me, before we come back on the air. So, but how are you doing? I see you're doing Habitat for Humanity in Chicago thing. That's interesting.
Yeah, I do that. And then I also just started tutoring recently. So in the evenings I tutor, and during the day I am a construction crew leader for Habitat.
Okay. Well, what about, you have any relationships? You getting married? What?
Yeah, I'm with someone, and we moved in together recently, and I would expect for that proposal to come sometime, let's say, hopefully in the next 6 months.
Oh, okay, so he knows this. He's got you tapping your foot, right?
Yep.
All right, good for you. All right, well, we'll go ahead, maybe we'll get into a little bit of that, but I mean, at least you're starting to live your life here. The thing is that what I worry is for someone like you coming out of a situation like that with the news and stuff that's going on and the economics and everything and the warmongering, whatever, the civil unrest of the whatever here, you're going, hell, man, did I bring it with me? I mean, are you feeling that at all?
I don't feel like that. I feel it was, the last year was actually really emotional for me. It was very difficult for me to get over being over there and coming back here. And now, just a year later, with everything that's happening, it is very emotional for me. There's a lot of times that I do break down because, I mean, those people treated me like family, and it's hard.
Well, here's an opportunity for you to give a little bit back and kind of share your personal experiences with them, so maybe that'll make you feel a little bit better.
Hopefully.
Well, I'm sorry you go through this stuff. I'm glad you're back, though. I mean, your family ought to be a lot happier you're here.
Yeah, I mean, they worried. In 2012, when they were bombing Gaza, they were very concerned because I was only a few hours away over there. But I don't know. I guess like I said, I feel a relationship with them now because of they were there for me after my mom passed away. They took care of me. The hospitality was amazing. It's just a completely different scale.
I didn't know
of
your mother
you
died.
Feel.
I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah, my father just died last week. So I'm hip. All right, we're starting in about 20 seconds. They do like a minute intro, and then we'll get right to it. And this is going to be relaxed. We're just going to talk. I'm going to ask a lot of questions. So no dead air on my show. Okay. So you just keep going, and I'll interrupt if I think I need to. But how you keep Ernie from talking is somebody else is talking. Know what I mean?
Okay. No problem.
Live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Interesting. Get caught up day to day here on the Declare. for Independence. I'm Ernest Hancock here in Phoenix, Arizona, from the BEAUT full studios of Freedoms of the Nest, freedomsphoenix.com. Okay, that's what we're doing. Marie Taylor, we weren't able to give her name out before. We had her on the show in the 12, around in there, is during Cast Lead, which are whatever the heck, you know, they always come up with new terms of where their project is in Palestine. Now, you know, you got the West Bank, you got Gaza, you got Israel, you got, and the borders keep changing, and pinky swear this is it, and then it changes kind of, but, you know, this just a game. I'm old enough, been around to see the lines on the board change a whole bunch, and Israel doesn't even really have borders. They don't recognize any. They go, yeah, well, this may be where we're not going, but later we'll get to the Euphrates later. I mean, you know, this is, it's kind of an interesting perspective that is going on there with our tax money, of course. So we had in the first hour Stephen Ledman. Now, Stephen Ledman is a prolific writer that, as he's retired, he just hit 80. He does a lot of stuff on war. His main focus is peace. Well, he spends a lot of time on Israel, Palestine, and on Gaza. I mean, I'm sorry, on Ukraine and whatever the hotspot du jour is. Did a lot on Iraq, Afghanistan. Well, he always focused, because there's so much news going on with whatever's going on in Israel. Well, we had a very good friend of mine's daughter got married, and her, and we were down there doing that, and her, I got beeping, what is that? Oh, it's a weather warning. Bombs are coming. The what happened was, as we did the wedding, she was the bridesmaid to a girl that Rachel, that I've known since she was a little bitty baby. And they're both architects, graduated from the University of Arizona. Well, Marie Taylor went to the West Bank. And I want to go ahead and tell her story, and from her perspective, she's in Chicago now, where Stephen Ledman is. I think it would be excellent. Donna, see if you can hook them up. Go ahead and we'll do that. Them to just meet. They're in Chicago together, just to talk from a young girl that's there. This would be awesome. That'd be a good thing for you to do, Marie. So what we're going to go ahead and do is get her experience when she left here, Southern Arizona, and goes to Palestine, which is very similar in climate. You know, so let's go ahead and go, Marie, you know, let's talk about that. Why, as a graduate from University of Arizona, you're architect, you get your architect card or whatever, and you're ready to go. How'd you wind up in Palestine? How did that even happen?
Well, actually, I went there originally the year before for a month program with one of the landscape architect professors, who also has a similar nonprofit group that works in Mexico, in a more of a landscape realm. But he had a good friend that he had met in graduate school, a Palestinian woman named Suad Amari. And she started a nonprofit back in the West Bank in her home that worked with architectural preservation. So we went over there, and I spent 2 weeks on the Israeli side, 2 weeks in the West Bank, and I really just fell in love. And then the year later, my mom passed away in that April, and I graduated that June, and I just thought, you know, I want to get away. Where did I feel the best, the most spiritual, the best feeling that I've ever felt? And I was the West Bank, and I had to go back.
Oh, that's why you went. Okay, I knew, you know, you had said that your mother had passed away, and they made you feel a lot. Okay, I didn't know. I thought it was at the time while you were there. No, you went there because your mother passed away, and you just wanted to, you know, go back to where you felt the best. Right? Can you hear me, Marie?
I'm having trouble hearing you every so often. I don't know what the problem is.
Cell phones! Okay. Well, this is what, you know, the one thing I remember, there was a young man, he's in his 20s, he travels the world, and he puts on different events, and he has his own subscribers and so on, and where to go, you're retiring, you have your money, he learned a lot from his father, and he's going around just being the young guy, you know, white American, going around and seeing where you're treated best. Because Americans have a lot of resources as they retire now, enough that they can pick a developing country and just chill. Palestine probably isn't that place, but you found a place where you were treated the best, that you enjoyed life. Tell me about that. Why was it that you felt better when you got every checkpoint, you got an M16 pointing at you? What was up with that?
That's true. I mean, going, crossing borders, traveling in Palestine is very difficult. like, and just even inside of the West Bank, crossing between cities because of the settlements. They build them in sort of a linear fashion rather than kind of a round or square fashion like most cities, because they're purposely built in order to start to separate and segregate the different areas of the West Bank. So, yeah, often you're going through those kinds of checkpoints, and, yeah, there are a lot of guns in your face. There's a lot of humiliation that happens. And when you're in the West Bank, they do they treat you more like a Palestinian than a foreigner. So you don't you won't have the same rights, really, that you will have when you're on the Israeli side. But the Palestinian people that are there, I mean, they've been living under oppression for decades. I mean, more than 50 years now. And, you know, there's a lot of angst and frustration that you see in that, but I see that more in the young generations that are coming up, just, you know, teenagers that are really struggling with this. But the people that have been living there and they're older, and the majority of people that you see and receive hospitality from, you know, they have a different disposition now. They've been living under this oppression for so long, and all they want is some sort of dignity, normalcy, and joy that is so hard to find. And so they just find it in little things. You know, so they really appreciate small things. So the way food is prepared, the way people have conversations. I mean, even at the office, there's definitely a lot of work being done when I was working over there, but you know, there was also coffee time was really important. Relationships were really important. You know, it's, you know, if I didn't ask about their family or their children or how they're doing, I mean, that's an issue. I mean, here you could work with someone and never even know if they're married or not sometimes. And over there, that's not acceptable. It's just more about the people and finding those moments for happiness. And you can feel it. I mean, they love to laugh and they love to tell jokes. And everything that they can do to have those feelings is what they're trying to do all day.
But what's
and
the
they
language?
Really are welcoming you.
What's the language that they speak?
Arabic. It's a Jerusalem dialect Arabic. And, I mean, originally, before the formation of Israel, even the Jewish cities and Jewish tribes that were there, they also spoke Arabic and Hebrew.
Okay, so what languages did you communicate in English? Did you learn their language? Which language? How good are you at it?
Palestinians are very educated, and they are learning English from when they are young. Some are just more apt. They are taught it in school. So some leave school, and they can speak English, and they'll go to a college, often in the United States or in the UK or some part of Europe. So English was, you know, and they love to try. Like, even if they didn't speak it for years, the taxi driver would love to try to speak English to me. I, being there for 2 years, did learn some Arabic, but I went in there not knowing any, so I would call myself intermediate Jerusalem Arabic.
So you can find the bathroom. Okay. So this
I can go to the grocery store. I can do those things.
Okay. When we come back, you know, we're going into the break. There was an operation going on when we talked before. It was called Cast Lead. And I'm like, what a name. You know, I mean, I guess they were casting lead. Why? Who is casting it? To whom or at whom were they casting it? You know, and why would they pick such a name? This is, you know, and then I'd like to find out why Marie left. I mean, heck, I can think of a gazillion reasons why you'd want to leave. But we're going to talk more with Marie Taylor when we come back here on Declare Your Independence in just a little bit. Okay, when we come back, I want to, in the first show that we did, we talked a lot about your actual living arrangements and so on. And at the time, I remember you saying that, you know, everybody was nice to you, but you have a beautiful young American girl. I mean, they're going to at least, I don't know, treat you differently, I would think. But you gave the impression that the way women in general are treated is different. So I'm wondering if after a couple of years there, was it that pretty held true? Or did you see that you were treated differently because you're a foreigner female? I mean, what do you think?
It really depends on the family upbringing of a gentleman. I mean, there are gentlemen there just like there are here, and there are guys who are not. And so there's a breadth of that. And but generally speaking, I would say that women are very respected And that's the bottom line. And to be treated any other way, in a non-gentlemanly way, is very disrespectful. And it's seen that way by their entire family. So they kind of self-regulate. Like, if I had a bad experience and I went to that boy's home, or that gentleman's home, because they don't leave home until they're married. So I could go to his mother and tell her, and he would just get lit up by his whole entire family.
Okay, now, when you come back and you're in Chicago, of all places, you know, where in Chicago do you live? Are you downtown, you know, little tiny apartment, high-rise, whatever? Are you in the suburbs, what?
I am not downtown, but I am in the city. I'm in the Humboldt Park area, so it's just named by the nearest very large park that's next to me. I live in a decent-sized apartment with two roommates, so...
Well, I mean, is it, you know, in the hood, or are you in a nicer place? People, you know, out your front door carrying briefcases, or what?
I live in a heavily Puerto Rican neighborhood, and I really enjoy it, actually.
Okay, so the comparison between there and Palestine, you would think that you were respected as a woman, or you feel safer where? I mean, I got Palestine, Chicago. Help me out here.
The comparison, I mean, here, even living, I mean, I know where the gang borders are where I am presently, and even so, I would feel so much safer here. Like, it just doesn't affect my daily life. It doesn't. Like, bad things can happen anywhere, but it doesn't affect me daily here. There, it's just more about terror. Like, they are trying to terrorize you. They're trying to make you feel fear. They're trying to make you not want to live.
Israelis?
Yes, the Israeli soldiers.
Okay,
that's
now,
their operation.
In Palestine, as you're there in the West Bank, Ramallah is where you were, right?
Yes.
Okay, in Ramallah, you know, are they patrolling just the borders, or are they inside the city?
According to the agreement over there, there's A, B, and C areas. A is completely Palestinian-controlled, and Israel should not... go into those areas.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and talk about that when we come. Let's talk about that when we come back. A, B, C. You know, but I want to kind of get a feeling of what's going on, and then as you talk to the people, you know, the whatever's going on now, how that's changing. You know what? Everything's just A or B or C. You know, and you know, it's just flat now. Or so. I mean, you know, we need to talk about, you know, how, because to me this has been systemic. As much as you think, okay, it's calmed down. All they're doing is just getting ready for the next whacking. You know, this is like a campaign.
Well, there's no getting ready. It's ongoing. It's been ongoing. It's never stopped going.
All right, let's talk about that. Here we go.
To be a part of the show, call 602-264-2800. 602-264-2800. And now, Ernest Hancock.
The Eastern world, it is exploding. Violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Song like that, you know, that has the same sentiments that's been going on forever, and I'm just wondering if Marie one was even aware of that song. I mean, this has been sentiments that have been going on since before I was your age, so you know, that's like a long time ago. So this, have you ever even heard that song, Eve of Destruction?
I feel like I've heard it, but not often.
You know, this is, it's the same mindset. It's like, the point that I'm making is that this is, it's never stopped. There's been an effort to take over Palestine. See, I'm not even sure I understand, you know, what is or is not Palestine. You know, why do they even have Gaza and the West Bank? That was just people they didn't exterminate earlier, or they're getting to them later, or pushing them out. I mean, it's not like I get the feeling that, are these people, you know, able to just be left alone? I mean, I don't understand what's going on. And you, in the break, you were saying I was wondering what was life like inside the West Bank. Do the Israelis just patrol the border, or are they walking the streets inside and you be able to be left alone? And you're saying there's a zone A, B, and C. What's that about?
Well, they do. There is a border and there is a wall that's being built. Some of it is a fence. I would think of it a lot like the fence that we talk about between us and Mexico. And parts of it are unbuilt, and parts of it are built on the line it's supposed to be built on, and parts of it go off of that line specifically to capture resources that they would otherwise not be able to capture if they actually followed the line. Now, in the West Bank, they have A, B, and C areas, which I dealt with a lot as a restoration architect, because it depends. It tells you who you have to deal with. In A areas, it should be Palestinian controlled by the Palestinian Authority. In C areas, it's all the way the opposite, and those are Israeli controlled areas inside of the West Bank, so settlements as well as checkpoints and many other large territories. Oftentimes, because of the steppe landscape there, there's not that much forestry. So if they find that there's an area like that, Israel will come in and say, okay, this is a green area. We need to preserve it. So we're going to make that a C area now, which is destructive because sometimes that's someone else's, well, it's always someone else's land, but sometimes it's something that they need for their livelihood and that sort of thing. So this is one of the ways that they kind of take control of area. And then you'll find in about 3 to 5 years, they start building on it. So that's just an interesting thing.
Yeah, it's just like an encroachment.
B areas.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
B areas. It's fine. So that's C. It's Israeli. B is kind of this in-between zone, which is where they can take all, they can kind of like usurp all these other areas from. But there's people, Palestinian people, that live in all of these areas. There's people they call Arab Israelis that still live on the Israeli side, and they won't call them regular Israelis, so they call them Arab Israelis. But when I was working, what happened is if I want to work in a village that's been zoned in a C area because recently a settlement was built nearby, these people no longer have the rights to build onto their house. So let's say they just got married and they have this little house. And when I say house, I mean like a one-room shack with an outhouse. This is the style of living that they will have. They'll put a concrete pad, build with some blocks, try to put a roof over their head for their family. And so they're like, okay, we have all these kids. We have six people living in one room now. We really want to just get some more concrete blocks and just make a little more space on our land. If they try to do that in any way, shape, or form, what Israel will do is they will put a demolition order on their house because they constructed something in Area C, and they're not allowed to do that.
Okay.
So
let me ask a couple of questions. One, while I'm thinking about it. You know, in this kind of environment, you know, people, I guess they would want them to leave. But when you say they're well-educated, Palestinians are educated by whom? I mean, who's doing the education? Is it a Israeli tax money thing, or are they doing it themselves? And when they go abroad to get education, you know, are they encouraged to leave? They just can't get back or something? I mean, tell me about the infrastructure there in Palestine. Who pays for it?
Well, rurally, they are less educated, and so it's easier for them to be taken advantage of. You know, the more you get into the city, there are universities inside of Palestine in the larger cities, so they have that option. And a lot of those
paid for by
universities,
who?
The students or the Palestinian Authority. But the thing is that by international law, as an occupied territory, Israel is required to provide services to these people. It's kind of like us in Puerto Rico, almost. Like, they should be taking care of these people that they've occupied for the last 50-plus years the same way we do our territories, but they don't. So, unfortunately, they receive no money and no funding from their occupier that they're supposed to. And so most of it is relied on in foreign aid, whether that's to the PA, the Palestinian Authority government receiving aid, or to the school receiving aid, or the students. I mean, they pay tuition just like we would pay tuition.
Okay, so this one of the problems that they have is they don't want people giving money, you know, from other countries and kind of sustaining or creating any kind of a a life for the people in Gaza and the West Bank and so on. That's one of the problem. You know, then they start bringing in ships or medicine or where they go. No, you're not allowed. They're trying. Is it like an intent to make it difficult, their life?
Yes, they want them to leave, and it's there's laws in place even where, like, if a Palestinian person does not return to their country in 4 years, so let's say they have that opportunity, they get grant money, they can go to the United Kingdom to go to college, amazing opportunity for this student. If they spend that whole time there, by the time they finish their degree, they are not allowed to see their family again.
Well, they got to make sure they save enough money to make a couple of trips back. Okay.
Exactly.
Now, the other thing is that when you were talking about how they can build or not build on their own land and do all, I mean, that's kind of what you were in as an architect. I remember this as a young man, you know, I'm in high school in the 70s and so on. A lot of the things that you described sound the same as South Africa. And I remember, you know, this anti-apartheid movement and U.S. boycotts and, you know, and eventually it put enough pressure on the South African government. And, you know, Mandela gets released and blah, blah, blah. But I'm going, then Israel seems like a totally different, like a double standard. There's something different going on. I get the feeling it's the same kind of a separation, but they get support from the U.S. Why? I mean, what is behind all that? I don't understand what's going on.
Honestly, this is a personal statement, but
we're
going to
save until we come back. Everybody sit on the edge of their seat. We're going to break. Marie was going to answer that really interesting question. Don't you want to know what the answer is? I do. When we come back here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and Marie Taylor. You know, Marie Taylor, a young woman that went as an educated architect here in the United States. You know, her mother died. Just, you know, she'd spent some time in Palestine. They made her feel good. She liked the people. So she went back, and this is what she's going to share.
This is Donna Hancock with Brangus Realty.
Okay, that's what we'll do. Just remember, we picked that up where we left that off, is the apartheid issue. What were you going to say? I want to make sure I get here to get you right back where you're going to go.
It's you were asking about our involvement in the apartheid, and I would say that, yes, first of all, definitely this is an apartheid situation. There is nothing about this can be refuted in any way when you look at when you compare the two. It's definitely. And even Jewish Americans here, a lot of them are comparing it to the Holocaust. So there's both of these comparisons that are happening with people that are against, you know, what Israel is doing in the moment. The other thing that I wanted to say is that as the United States, you asked what's our involvement. We are a huge part of the problem. The funding, right now there's a proposition in California, even with all of this going on in Gaza, to send more arms to Israel. And there's been two times now that California senators have filibustered Palestinian Americans talking on C-SPAN about losing their family members in Gaza and the West Bank right now.
You know, my thing, I'm. What about this Iron Dome thing? Is that all BS or what?
Oh, it's really BS. I mean, it's there. It's technically there, but it's not nearly as effective as Israel wants you to believe.
Well, I mean, is there anything even to be effective against? I mean, how much? See, I never understood that. You got rockets coming out of, I mean, is it really Palestinians or Hamas, or is it just, you know, false flagging crap or what? I mean,
it's Hamas and the Islamist jihadists. But the thing is that both of those things are very misunderstood because of our media. There's a lot of Palestinians, even in the West Bank, who would say they are pro-Hamas because Hamas is actually a political party. And so it has, you know, stances, just like the Republican Party has many different stances, or Democrats, you know what I mean? So you could be pro-Hamas and still be anti-violence. So this is an issue.
But what was it, Hamas? I mean, what's the general knowledge there that Hamas was created by Israel to begin with?
No, I actually don't know a lot about that. I do think that because of the lack of, you know, there's a lot of corruption. It's an issue. There's a lot of anti-corruption societies in Palestine because of the money, because there's so much economic depression. I have heard and would believe that Mohammed Abbas is also part of this puppeteering because he both, you know, exhilarates Palestinian people, but then kind of like poo-poos some things or doesn't do some just basic legislative stuff that he really should be doing. So I think there's definitely some of that. But I don't think that an entire party was created by Israel, but there's for sure a ton of corruption.
Okay, let me look. I'll do just a wiki thing. Hamas, let's see, based on the principles of founded in 87 during the first infa. Okay, blah, blah, blah. Israel, section, European. Yeah, see, I don't see that Hamas, anything is allowed to be without, you know, it being taken advantage of either as a bad guy or doing what they want or having somebody to sign a deal saying, yeah, this doesn't belong to you anymore. I mean, it's just, I don't trust anything, you know? I mean, it's just, I'm just wondering what their perspective is. All right, we're starting in 10 seconds. Here we go.
This is the Liberty Radio Network, broadcasting the latest liberty-oriented audio content 24 hours a day at LRN.fm.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
You know, I'm in a funk. I mean, I just want to know what, I tell you what the truth is. The truth is that, battle lines are being drawn. By whom? You know, So you talk to a young woman that spent time living with the people in Palestine. Define, Marie, help me out. When they say Palestine, what the heck does that even mean? I mean, you got two different places in Israel. Is Gaza and the West Bank, are they tied in some way? You know, you can't be like mayor of both, can you? I mean, you got to go through a bunch of checkpoints.
Well, the Palestinian Authority is technically for all of Palestine. The problem with Gaza is that there are, you know, when Israel was formed, a lot of refugees were made. It was a huge port city, and so it was harder for them to just kind of displace people from it, just as a lot of the other major Palestinian cities are in the West Bank. So they built a huge blockade around it and made it into a ghetto because that was just an easier thing for them to control.
Okay, so let's talk about the apartheid thing that we, you know, kind of, because as a young person that was, when I was your age, this was like a big deal in South Africa, and there was never, you know, it was like there was no way this was going to stop, that, you know, those in control of the guns were not going to, like, give up power, and it finally got to where it was just a political thing. It was advantageous to the West, or so I don't know what the difference was and how they got everybody on. It was more of a social movement. It was a lot easier where you got white Europeans and black, you know, historical ancestry of the people that were there. I mean, it was a definite color contrast. Now, when you look at Israel and Palestine, don't the people, they favor each other? Is it European, you know, light skin versus dark skin? Or is it, I mean, what? How do they make the differentiation? I mean, is it who wears a yarmulke and who has, a head dressing? I mean, how do they know? How does it manifest itself on the street?
I mean, it is easy for them in the sense that Palestinians are generally light-skinned, but still darker than most Israelis. When the movement started years ago, it was after World War II, so it was about what these Holocaust victims, needed. And at the time, Britain was in control of this territory. That doesn't mean that these people weren't living on the land and didn't own their own land, but governmentally it was controlled by Britain. And so there was a proposition in the United Nations when it was recently formed to, partition the land and give some of it to these victims. Well, the problem became that they wanted to partition the land more for them, even though there was less of their population and less for the people that actually live there. And then things started to arise and become, you know, a problem. I think that because of that, they are still significantly lighter skinned than the Palestinian people most of the time. Also, the Palestinian people tend to be farmers, so they're also just generally tan. So you have that also, just to accentuate it. Now that the conflict's been going on for a long time, there's definitely always been Jewish tribes and Jewish cities in Palestine. There's really great old footage of a Jewish man before this ever happened, praying at the Wailing Wall in Arabic and in Hebrew, because he was living there amongst those people. There are still Jewish people in the West Bank that are anti-Israeli, that renounce Israel, that will not be a part of it. They believe that it is not their religious right. They think that it's wrong. So you have all these kinds of, this whole mixture of people happening. But bottom line, as far as apartheid, it is pretty easy for them to tell. When it's not, where lines have kind of crossed, you will see that there are a lot of yarmulkes that people wear. Also, women in solidarity, you know, previously 98% of Palestinian women did not wear a headscarf, the hijab. They just didn't. It wasn't part of their culture. You won't see it in old photos or old videos. This is an influence that has come with Arab solidarity because of the conflict. And now you'll see it's completely switched, where 98% of them do wear it.
Wow. This is interesting in your lifetime to have had this experience, and you go, no, I was there. I know these people. I can call them up. I can Skype them. I think we Skyped with you the last time we did the interview. You were in the West Bank, right?
Yeah, I was sitting in my apartment there in Ramallah.
This is, okay, so from your perspective there, Hamas is what? Is it a movement? Is it a party? Is it, it's just like, you know, what does it mean to the people there? Not what we define it as. You know, the people in Palestine, yeah, Hamas, do they represent them? Whatever they say we go by? Or do they have like, no, I'm independent of, you know, screw Hamas? Or, I mean, what's the role we keep hearing that word?
Well, it is a political party, but the Palestinians like parties. They don't have just Fatah and Hamas. They have at least six that are pretty big, and then they have others still that are smaller as far as politics go. So Hamas is actually a political party. It's a problem in the words that we use in our media. We've kind of defined it as these are the violent terrorists, and the Fatah is the nonviolent group that's working in the West Bank, and that's both true and untrue. I've met plenty of people in the West Bank that are pro-Hamas, that are nonviolent, just because it is a political party. Just like Republicans or Democrats, you could be a Republican and not agree with everything that's going on in the party at present. Or same thing with the Democrats. So it's that sort of
thing. No, if you're a Republican, you must, like, bomb people and crap. That's what they say on Fox. Okay, so this is when you watch our cable news here, and you, I mean, do you get any truth out of it, or do you think it's all twisted, or you just like, I break with all of them, or I mean, like MSNBC, do they tell the truth? You know, is it CNN the truth? Is Fox the truth? Is any one of them worth a crap?
No, actually, no. Unfortunately, it's all very biased, and a lot of it has to do with their higher-ups. I mean, most of our media is inside of a conglomerate at this point, and most of that is, unfortunately, attached, you know, in our global environment to this conflict in an inextricable way where they cannot communicate to us the way that they should as good journalists.
Well, where do you get information? I mean, I you know, I'm on my Roku, my internet TV, and I go, Russia Today, yeah, okay, I give them, I'll put that on there. I know better than to put MSNBC. I mean, am I putting Al Jazeera up? We started using Al Jazeera to follow Iraq, Afghanistan back in the day. Hell, if I didn't go to the Russian and Al Jazeera television or something, you couldn't even get another perspective and try to even ferret out some truth in there. So, I mean, where do you go? I mean, who do you trust?
Al Jazeera used to be a better option than it is now. Again, because of the global scene, there's a lot of people just in the Middle East in general who will know that no longer respect Al Jazeera. They've become part of this like whole media regime or whatever you want to call it. Yeah. So they don't look to it anymore. For me, it was really hard coming back to the U.S. and not being there and seeing what was happening. So I tend to turn to more grassroots organizations to try and understand a perspective and what's happening. There are some, and I'm always looking for very non-biased sort of reports. I have a lot of friends that are kind of like all over the board, so conversations about this can be very complicated. But one thing I always talk to them about is like, okay, well, show me where you got that information. But if it's an Israeli newspaper, I'm probably not going to accept that as a non-biased source. Similarly with the U.S.
But when we come back, what I want to talk about is the propaganda around the Iron Dome, you know, and the rockets from the Palestinian-held areas. You know, are there? How much? The damage? The intent? The result? More when we come back. That's what I, you know, this, as you're there, I mean, there's reports of, oh, and they sent a rocket and did a rocket, and oh, it's been too long between rockets, we need another rocket. And I'm going, you know, I mean, I need to know what that, the perspective that they have there. Yeah, we sent a rocket. Is it, you know, I don't understand. I you know, the goal is to what? To have another house bulldozed or something, or to create the tent? I don't get it. You know, I don't understand who benefits from whatever. You know, so, and the tunnels. I want to talk, you know, let me write that down. The tunnels and so on, they keep making a big deal about. You're not allowed to have a tunnel. Okay. So these are the things I want to discuss when we come back, okay?
Okay.
Okay, tunnels, rockets, you know, and then, of course, you know, do a little bit of that, and then we'll get into the future. You know, what's the future? Now, you know, because I'm getting the impression that Israel is, their whole goal is march east. I mean, they're not done. You know, I don't think. Is there something that's going to make them happy? Okay, you got this. Are you done now? Oh yeah.
No.
Okay, we're done.
They're never going to be satisfied. They make a lot of money off the occupation. They have very few regulations. Like corporations there can make a lot of money, for example, because they don't have to worry about, let's say, toxic waste removal, because they have a huge land area where they feel comfortable just tossing that. So that's a cost that they don't have. There's all of these sorts of things. They have very cheap labor because of the apartheid situation, so they make a lot of money off of that. I mean, just economically speaking, there
is
no reason
for this. Do they have Israeli factories in Palestine?
What they do is they build them on the border with the wall, and then they open the doors to allow the Palestinians to work for them for super cheap, and then they push them back in the evenings.
Okay, I mean, is there like a hatch, a door in the wall going into the factory, or is it, you know, down the street a little bit, or what?
Yeah, or adjacent to the factory. Yeah, basically.
I mean, they actually
there's also
share a wall with the wall?
Yeah, I mean, they built walls directly through cities at times. There are neighbors that you have, you know, that live there for 50 years and had relationships that no longer see each other, so it's the same sort of thing.
Wow. Was there any wall construction going on while you were there?
I did not see it. There was definitely wall construction going on. We give them, as the U.S., I think like $10 billion for their wall every year.
Okay.
And they don't build it economically. I have seen them build a U-shape with this huge wall, like, that you can stand and see. It looks like a giant nipple, just to take a well or some, or part, you know, these things that they want to take. It's crazy. It's wasteful. If nothing else, it's wasteful.
Is there a documentary that you would recommend that would give a perspective that you think is balanced?
There, I would have to find the name for it. There is one where a gentleman, a foreign gentleman, tries to walk the wall
So he goes from one, just starts at one side and tries to go to the other and walks it. He's arrested multiple times. I think it's a really interesting perspective because he is foreign. He's not a Palestinian person. There's also a good one called Budrus, B-U-D-R-U-S, that I think is fairly non-biased. It's hard to have known at all.
Okay, we'll talk about it.
But it's also a really good depiction.
All right, here we go.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
American woman, the U.S. government, America, just stay away from me. I don't want to, you know, leave me aloneism. You know, but that we're not. I mean, we're spending billions and billions and billions of dollars to support, I'm not even sure what. You know, let's talk about the wall a little bit. You know, when you create a wall, you have people on this side and on that side. I mean, sometimes all you need is a railroad track on the other side of the tracks, you know, that kind of thing. There's always some barrier. Well, it wasn't enough of a barrier. It weren't enough, you know, I don't know, guns or something. So, and a wall. So here we got this wall. And will the wall ever come down? Well, I remember my generation, you know, the older generation, they were freaking out about the Berlin Wall. Oh, it'll never come down. It'll never come down. As young people, we're looking, we're going, of course it'll come down. I mean, hell, you got people speaking the same language on both. What? You know, I'm shocked it stayed up. And then when it came down, they're all shocked. CIA, all shocked. Everybody's shocked. We're going, right. You know, we're thinking you're just stupid for thinking it was going to last. Hell, I'm shocked it lasts as long as it did. Well, the same thing will sooner or later will eventually happen, you know, with the Palestinian-Israeli wall. And it's going to be a generational thing. It's going to be Marie Taylor and her friends in Palestine. That, you know, I hate even saying that. You know, in Palestine. What the heck does that even mean? I mean, we'll talk about the wall in a second. But when I say your friends in Palestine, what does that mean? Gaza's not even connected to the West Bank. Do they consider it one culture or country or city? What's their perspective on that, Marie?
Well, the Palestinians still feel that, I mean, just in general, whether or not a lot of them have accepted that there's going to be either a one state or two state solution, and they're okay with that. But when they speak about Palestine, they still speak of it in a traditional sense, which would be the way that you see Israel on the map generally, just that entire wedge, which is also the way that the Israelis see Israel. So really neither side particularly sees all these interior divisions unless it has to do with, you know, the conflict itself.
Well, who is it that sees it as separate? I mean, is there a generational thing? Is there any group or, you know, you got the Jewish and the Palestinian women coming together to play bridge and can't we all just get along thing? Is there a movement in that?
There are definitely movements. Unfortunately, in Israel, they are on the Israeli side of things, those movements are very suppressed. And they do it in secret because of that. There has been a lot of protests right now. You probably have seen on TV, online, the protests happening in the West Bank, you know, thousands of people. These things are also happening in Tel Aviv by, you know, Jewish Israelis that are against the war. But the reason you don't see a lot of that is, A, it's fewer, which is unfortunate. There's not as many people involved. But, B, Israel doesn't want you to see the backlash. Those people are being beaten in the streets by other Israeli people because of the difference of opinions. So they don't want you to see the violence that's happening in their country right now because of there are people in Israel that are against what's happening. And you're right, there are women, Jewish women and Palestinian women that meet as a group secretly, and they come at night and allow their kids to play or in the early morning so that their children can play together and hopefully grow up with this idea you know, without this conflict in mind. Or
culture. Culture. That's all. It's always culture. You overcome all this stuff with culture. You know, this is, let's go through a couple things before we run out of time. We have the tunnels. I want to, you know, talk about it because they're making, oh, they got tunnels. They're like, you know, traveling without getting bombed on. They deliberately ducked and they're not allowed. Okay. So we talk about that. The future, I get the impression that there are groups or parties or an ideology of people in charge with the guns or whatever that, hey, man, we're not done until we get to the Persian Gulf or something. You know, I'm not sure what's going on there. Then we have, you're saying like businesses, you know, they see Palestine as, you know what, they don't have an environmental protection agency. So what we're doing, we're just going to build a border factory that shares a wall with the wall, you know, put a little hatch in the wall and we get cheap labor and then send them back at night and dump all our crap over there and got, you know, we got that going on. We, as U.S. taxpayers, spend billions of dollars, you know, financing all of this. I find that of interest. And then, you know, the wall itself, they'll just meander the wall in such a way to take whatever reason. Oh, there's a well. Well, we got a, you know, like you called it a nipple. It just goes out from the wall just to incorporate the well. And not so much that whether they need it or not is that they don't have it. You know, the Palestinians aren't allowed. And then there are documentaries that you suggested. This one gentleman walking the wall, that documentary, just him going or trying to walk along the wall and what he came across there. And then another one called Boutros that you mentioned.
Boutros.
Boutros. Yeah. Okay, I just wanted to get that all that out. Let's talk about the use of Palestinians as labor. You know, the building factories. Tell me about that. We have kind of an experience called maquiladoras here in the United States. They go across, you know, like a lot of people in Sun City West retirees, they got a caravan that goes down for medical treatment and dental and get their teeth done and they get their prescription drugs and then they come back. You know, so tell me kind of your experiences on factories and such taking advantage of cheap Palestinian labor.
Well, I mean, it's the, when I was first introduced to it, it was with the permitting program, which is actually where a Palestinian person needs to get a work permit so then they can cross over just for the day in order to work in Israel, because the economic depression is so deep there, one of the deepest in all of the Middle East. So it's very serious. But there are factories that do take advantage of this. So they have their safety on the Israeli side of the wall, and they build a factory there, and they have big doors, huge doors, that they open and allow Palestinian workers to work for, you know, a low wage. They do work for a very unlivable wage. And then they, you know, just let them go home to their families in the evening. And it's very difficult. It's very humiliating for the Palestinian people because they don't want to work for their oppressor, but they don't really have much other choice in order to take care of their family. And when they weigh the options, they would say, I want to feed my children, so I'm going to go work at this Israeli factory.
Well, what's the future? What do you see? What's the mood? See, it's almost this rocket thing. I don't even understand that. It just seems so contrived. It is, you know, you all of a sudden you're looking in your backyard and somebody's launching a rocket, you know, or are they even really doing it? I don't. How is that seen?
They, well, first of all, they are definitely doing it. That's a real thing. The problem is that the way they want you to, that the Israel and the media wants you to perceive it, is it's much more dangerous than it is. Now, basically, they use their underground tunnels with Egypt in order to get materials. It's usually just a big iron tube that they cut up and weld down and put some stuff in so that they can shoot this iron tube through the air. There's no explosives. There's nothing like that happening. So I can't say that it's not dangerous. If it strikes, let's say, an apartment building, it is dangerous in the sense that it will project through a room. It won't explode. It won't kill multiple levels of people. If you happen to be in its path, you will die. And that's
why do they do
every
it?
Year there's a few casualties, maybe like six.
Why do they do it?
Well, imagine yourself under this oppression for 50 years, and you are in this blockade. You can never leave. You can never see your family that's outside of there. You can never travel. You can't fish for your own livelihood. And now you have to attempt to grow enough vegetables on your roof for everybody that lives in all the floors underneath you because there's no agricultural land. You're getting frustrated, and nobody's listening. Like, there was a time when, you know, the Palestinian diaspora was on everybody's mind, it was a big deal, but now for how many decades they're just going relatively unheard. And I think this is the issue. There's
I packed the tube with a bunch of leaflets, man. I mean, you know, I understand.
I don't think, I mean, people have been doing nonviolent protests in the West Bank, and they do every Friday. There are huge movements of nonviolence, and they, you know, talk about Martin Luther King in school, and it's a really big deal for them. It's not working for them. It's not.
Yeah.
And that's a really sad thing, but it is not working. And that's when these things start to happen. They're like, all right, we don't want to kill a bunch of people. We don't want there to be a bunch of bloodshed, but we need the global environment to hear us, because they're the only ones that can help us. They can't help themselves. They have been denied weapons. They don't have any way to fight back. They have no economy whatsoever.
So the rocket is like some kid in the street throwing a rock at a tank.
Yeah, it's more like a flare. It's like, please look at us.
Okay, where do you think, just real quick, we'll do a little bit of post here in the archive, but, you know, where do you think this goes? Is there an end to this, or is it just perpetual war?
If there's going to be an end to it, it's not going to come from Israel and Palestine. It's going to come from outside of the conflict, and a big part of it needs to come from the U.S., because we're the ones putting the most money and the most positive spin on it that it doesn't need to have.
Okay, we're in break now. We can still finish the conversation, but if you're sitting on the sideline, having been there and have a perspective of our news and theirs, and kind of you're in a very, very rarefied, unique position as a young woman that has experienced probably more than most. And I'm just going, what's your solution? What do you see? Is it the most effective thing is the Jewish and Palestinian women letting their kids play together late at night? I mean, is that it?
It is a start. I mean, there are also Jewish women there that I've tried to be more positive than negative, but there are women in Hebron that are teaching their children to discriminate. They teach them to pour bottles of urine out the windows on the Arabs. They teach them these things purposefully. And in Hebron, a lot of them are Brooklynites, actually, which is crazy. And that's the thing. A lot of the very extreme settlers are from the United States. And I think a huge problem is that we offer to Israel dual citizenship. I mean, how many countries do we offer that to? Not very many. So there's a lot of people that actually live here most of their life and are Israeli and also the U.S. that vote here, that give money to AIPAC for the lobbying. I mean, we are a huge problem. It's us. We're the problem.
When you say we're, I mean, is it a government thing? Is it a capture of our government? Is it AIPAC runs the world? I mean, I'm define that. You know, it's us. I mean, what?
I think it's all of us.
Us
I
as
think
in
it's
U.S.?
Our government. I think it's our government. Yes, it's our government, but it's also our complacency. I mean, we don't deal with a lot of these issues on our own soil. So it's just us being complacent. AIPAC been able, because of this complacency, to say that they speak for all Jewish Americans, and that's really untrue. There are some really good sites, like the Jewish Voice for Peace, that are really standing up right now, and they're doing a lot of civil disobedience, particularly in Los Angeles, just trying to make the point. And it's a movement that's getting started that says, AIPAC doesn't speak for us. We're Jewish. We are against Israel.
Okay, now this attitude in Israel itself, because everybody's got to do their, I don't know, couple of years in the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, and I'm going, okay, yeah. I've known, Jewish friends of ours, they went to ASU, I remember his wife was IDF, and they came here, and she worked for Intel, and we get a lot of stories and how, and you talk to other people, and they go to ASU, and they put on, seminars at U.S. people are good Jewish boys here. You can come work, be in the IDF, and you'll get dual citizenship, and you can be part of, in Israel, yeah.
Well, and how messed up is that? If I go serve in another army for their cause, let's just say people are going to attack Costa Rica, and they don't have an army, and I really believe in them, so I want to go and support them. I can't do that. If you do that, it revokes your right to American citizenship. But here, we say, it's okay for you to go fight in our military for our cause, and then also to go and be required at that point to serve for 2 years for this other government all the way across the pond.
Yeah, see, when you say, we say, I'm going, it's like everybody goes to me, they go, they who? And I go, you know, they, them, those, the ones that won't leave me alone. I mean, you know, that's who they are. So when you say
our
we...
government.
Well, yeah, see, it's a government, and I'm going, you know, that's just, and they go, well, it's just the people, and we, blah, 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 blah. You know, I'm just, I that's why I'm so anti-collective, you know, anti-government. I don't want any level of government to represent me. I mean, I'm just trying to avoid them, get out of their way. I see the United States under as much occupation, maybe not as bad, but we're under occupation just like all these other places. I mean, it's just, I don't see a government solution. You see my point?
Have you seen... Yeah, I mean, but it's similar. Have you seen the solidarity movement of the Gazans for the Ferguson shooting?
No.
Well,
I mean, don't surprise me.
You can find information about how the St. Louis County Police Chief received training in Israel, and you can see some of those tactics that are similar. And this is coming from an Israeli group called 972 Mag. It's a magazine.
972 Mag, okay.
Mag, so mag.com. And so these are Israeli people.
Okay, mag.com, M-A-G.com?
Yeah, so it's actually a magazine, 972 Magazine, but the site is 972mag.com.
972 Mag, okay. Yeah, Donna's hooking it up, putting it up in the second hour. That's awesome. I wish we had time to do that. I got another guest I got to get to. But
there's one other one, if you're going to put something up, called breakingthesilence.org.il.
Breakingthesilence.org.il.
And that is an Israeli also site that is soldiers from the IDF coming out and speaking about atrocities that they've committed anonymously.
Yeah, we've had a lot of stuff up that, you know, kind of depicts that, but I'm like, see, I see it as a cultural thing. It's this kind of stuff. It's a Facebook campaign of I love Iran and Iran loves Israel kind of stuff. I mean, you know, if you're not doing, if you don't have a cultural, social backing of this, then you're not, because that's what happens. Anybody shows any kind of leniency or humanity, and all of a sudden, you know, they're killed. I mean, you're not allowed, you know?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm counting on you and your generation. You know, I'll do what I can to help. But, you know, you and your friend, if you got somebody in Israel that wants, or Palestine, or whatever, wants to talk and share, let me know. The mic's open for them.
Oh, I can find plenty of people.
Do it. Waiting on you now.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Marie. I got to go.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is the Onion Week in Review. Sources are confirming your dog died earlier today, and we're all really sorry you had to find out about it like this, buddy. Though it's a lousy thing to have to learn from an online web video, and even shittier to hear from a cold, hardened newsman's voice that you can't put a face to, your pet passed away in his sleep while you went out today, and we understand how shocked you must be right now. Sources added that there are many local shelters with animals in need of a good home, though we understand that no dog can ever truly replace the one you just lost. I lost a dog once, but my mom was the one who told me about it, and she was quite the comfort. In this week's op-ed pages, Pantene CEO Marcus Russo laments feeling like the only one who gives a shit about rich, lustrous hair. In other news, a study finds that newborn infants can tell if their parents are losers. A man who just assembled a desk is unsure how he has every screw left over. And Jeff Beck is lured into a dark alley with the old guitar pick on a string trick. For more, visit theonion.com/newsbeat.
This is the Onion News Network.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are here!
Oh, now
we have Marie Taylor, architect here locally from Phoenix. She graduated University of Arizona, I got to know, and she went to Palestine, worked there, gave it. She's going to get us hooked up with some of her friends in Palestine. She's here 2 years, so she knows some people. We're going to get that hooked up. But we're going to go with the light. We're going to go with the positive, the good stuff. And who's going to help us out with that? Michael Belfiore, B-E-L-F-I-O-R-E. I just found out that he has a newsletter. And I just signed up. I'm going, how did I not know this? This better be a new thing. Because, you know, if he had this before and he didn't tell me, I'm going to, you know, verbally slap him around. You know, how come I didn't know about your newsletter? Because he's written the book, The Department of Mad Scientists, How DARPA is Remaking Our World from the Internet to Artificial Limbs. This is behind the scenes of all the high-techy, you know, and Google buying up every robot there ever was. You know, that kind of stuff. Now, he did also write, and we had him on us the first time that we got to talk about. I didn't even know this book was written like a year, two, three, four before I even talked to him. If I had known, we'd had him on earlier. Rocketeers, how a visionary band of business leaders, engineers, and pilots is boldly privatizing space. We're going to space, and government's not invited. Well, at least by some people. Though, what happened is Michael Biafore, he's written for, everything. New York Times, Popular Science, Popular Mechanics, Smithsonian, Air and Space, Financial Times, on and on and on. Get the drift? You know? So now what did we have? We had a we just put it up. Should be up on the front page today or be later today. I sent it last night to staff to put up. And SpaceX did something very, 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 very cool, Michael Biafore. What was it that they did that was very cool? Tell me everything.
Oh, well, SpaceX is moving along with reusable booster rockets, which is an industry first, and that could be the key enabler to finally getting people out into space in large numbers on a regular basis for relatively reasonable cost, which is the key element, because most of these boosters get thrown away after every launch. And if you can bring them back, well, you can just refuel them and go again, just like an airplane, right?
Yeah, nine big, giant, expensive, oh my God, engines just got saved with a little bit more fuel. Here's some kerosene, and I bring them back.
You got it. Yeah. Yeah, very exciting time. And there's also a lot going on in the suborbital space realm. A lot of people don't know really what the distinction is, but it is important. You can either go all the way up to orbit, which, you know, needs 25 times the speed of sound to get there and a couple hundred miles up. Or you can go just 62 miles up to the boundary of space and go Mach 3, three times the speed of sound, and then you can do all kinds of interesting things, like do, you know, multiple flights per vehicle per day, maybe go point to point on Earth and get from New York to Sydney in a couple of hours, that sort of thing.
Well, this is, how close are we to that?
We're really close. So Virgin Galactic is the, you know, the lead as far as the press is concerned. Most of the mainstream press is talking about Richard Branson, right? And he says he's going to go up this year himself with a couple of family members on the inaugural revenue flight and open the gates for a lot of people have been signed up now. I think about 700 now people paying $250,000 each to get a ride on that thing. But there's also a startup called X-Core Aerospace, which is really very far along as well, and they may be doing their first flights this year, too. And that's not even including Blue Origin. That's another company run by Jeff Bezos who wants to do the same thing.
Yeah, wait. Okay, you mentioned Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos. You got to give me some insight on that, because they're pretty clandestine. What the hell are they doing?
Yeah, they are.
Okay, go ahead and introduce who Jeff Bezos is and what he's doing and where it started and why. And he's doing this, I'm going to deliver Amazon packages with drones, and then he doesn't say, oh, yeah, by the way, we're going to do it with a rocket.
Yeah, that's right. Jeff Bezos, notoriously tight-lipped, doesn't want to reveal anything until he's ready to. And he's been working on this private space program called Blue Origin that he's funding for years now. And I got word from one of his people at a conference not too long ago that they're going to start test flying their first full-size vehicle, meaning the one that can fly people. So they want to enter this suborbital tourist/spaceflight participant/researcher market, which hasn't existed before. And he's got an interesting take. Everyone else is doing people flying them, you know, pilots at the controls. Well, he's all about automation, right? So he made this announcement about drones delivering packages autonomously. That's what he wants to do in the next few years. That's what he wants to do with space flight, too. It'll be remote controlled or probably mostly autonomous, a computer-controlled vehicle.
Monkey in a can. Yeah. You know, see, that was a big complaint of the Mercury astronauts, and they went to Gemini and, you know, and Apollo and so on. They're going, hey, man, you're just throwing us in this can. I need some control. I'm a pilot. Give me a window. I mean, damn, you know? So this is, hopefully Bezos takes that seriously. As a passenger, I'd like... Is there an escape hatch here somewhere?
Yeah.
So what's his?
Yeah,
what's
right.
How's he define it? I mean, what's it for? Cargo or people or what?
It's for people. He wants to do people. You know, a lot of these people just think it's a good idea to get people into space, and they've got money, so they're going to do it, and they're going to hope the market is there for it. Well, the Virgin Galactic proved that there is a market. Actually, before that, Space Adventures did. They got people flying up to the International Space Station for, you know, $20 million and up. Now it's up to around between $60 to $70 million for a flight on the space station.
Yeah, but that you got to take a Russian freaking rocket to get there.
That's right. That's a big
damn capitalist
hurdle. Right. Besides the money, you got to learn Russian and go to Russia and train for 6 months. So that's why the suborbital missions are really interesting to me, especially Virgin Galactic and X-Corps. They've got the old fashioned, you know, pilot behind the controls. It's like the old barnstorming days. So if I'm a passenger or a spaceflight participant, a lot of them like to be called, instead of you know, passenger or tourist, because they actually get to help design their own mission and maybe bring their own experiments on board. Well, they're much more part of the action. They get to sit up in X-Corps' case. You get to sit right next to the pilot and maybe do some control function or monitoring of instruments and things like that. So for my money, that's the experience that I would like to have.
Heck yeah. Donna, we're going in the Uber high mile club. You know, that's my experiment. Okay.
So that's right.
So this is, you know, I'm looking at, I remember Burt Rutan, he was, his big goal was to be able to go up into an acrylic dome or something where he'd have full experience without a suit, just kind of floating there, watching the world literally go by. You know, I mean, that's you know, that's going to be the money shot. You know, is somebody close to that?
Burt Rutan, he is a true visionary. And use the past tense because he's not with the Virgin Group anymore. He was the founder and head of Scaled Composites, which is building Virgin spaceships. And he left a few years ago, retired. And, you know, it looks to me as though things have stagnated a bit. They don't have that visionary guy at the helm anymore. And they're struggling with a rocket motor that seems to be underpowered to get 6 people up there, actually 8 with the pilot and co-pilot. So it's interesting to me that Brian Binney, who was one of the XPRIZE pilots that proved that you could do this back in 2004, he's moved down the flight line at the same airport down to X-Corps Aerospace, their competitor. So now he's full-time with them as their chief test pilot.
Really?
And so that is a really interesting development. Yeah.
Okay, now X-Corps, go ahead and talk about that's the Lynx or something, right?
Yeah, they've got the X-Corps Lynx, which right now they're building on their shop floor. These guys are really interesting because there's only like 50 people working there. And so they don't have the big, deep pockets of Richard Branson, but they've been slowly but surely building these reliable rocket engines that have the power to get up there.
Well, they're only sending up 2 people, though, right?
2 at a time, that's right.
Yeah, so this is, you know, you're right when they, you know, Burt, see, that's why I knew we were going to space. We started covering that in 03, and by June of 04, our listenership, we went to the Mojave, saw the first one, had our science, spaceship one, government zero, everything. Why? Because Burt Rutan was involved. Well, now he's not.
This is Donna Hancock with Brian.
Yeah, that's one thing that got me. We're in break now, but I'm, you know, with Burt not there, I was looking forward to him doing a lot of something, and I thought that he was kind of focusing on ground effect vehicles, you know, for rapid transportation on Ocean City, kind of 12 miles out, and I don't have to, you know, brave the L.A. traffic, and I just go to the port and I live out there, you know, kind of thing. So I could see I'm going, ooh, Burt's doing that, let's go. But I haven't really heard anything. You know, do you know what he's doing?
Yeah, he's out in Idaho, retired. He's taking cruises around the world, just kind of hanging out. I'm sure he's working on stuff. I mean, a guy like him doesn't quit, really, but he's not in the spotlight anymore, and he's not with Scaled. I mean, he just left. He just cleared out and left, never looked back, never came back. People are like, whoa, That was fast.
Well, what was that about? I mean, he just said, I did my bit, I'm done, you know?
Yeah, I think so. Retired. And, you know, he's not a production guy either. They were focusing on production now with Virgin. They're going to build 5 spacecraft, all of the same design. And he's a guy who knocks off a new design per year and flies it. So once he's out of that, you know, experimental realm, he's not as hooked in, you know.
Well, he's probably, and you got, you know, software now that he's got the nice, he just takes his laptop with him and he's doing whatever the hell he wants if he wants to, or he just bite me and I'm done. You know, the one thing is, I think he may have had a disillusionment with just the United States government in general. He was a real America flag waving kind of America guy, way more than I anticipated. I mean, I knew he wanted to send the message, you know, spaceship one, government zero. I mean, he was kind of really wanted to do that, but I think it ate at him a little bit.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, he's definitely for, you know, freedom of action and freedom of commerce and all that stuff. And wanted to do your own thing. That's why, partly why he ended up out in the desert, where it's much easier to do that.
Well, it's, you know, I remember the story, one of the Mojave guys there going to the FAA, we need a permit. Well, we don't have a permit. Well, I need a permit saying I don't need a permit. I mean, you know, they just created their own kind of regulation and stuff. And I could see, because I remember when Burt got his Medal of Freedom from the Reagan administration when they did Voyager, that he made a big deal out how easy it was just to go around the world without anything other than I filed the flight plan. Well, going to space is, you know, it's getting so bureaucratic now. I just know it eats at him, and there's something that I wouldn't be surprised if he goes out with, here's my secret DVD file of the, here it is, and go do it. You know, do you have any idea what he might be working on?
Boy, you got me. Anything's possible. And he's the kind of guy, too, who keeps everything really close to the vest until he's got something to show. So, you know, it could be he's toiling away on something out there, and he'll just come out and, you know, fly in some kind of hyperjet to Oshkosh one of these days.
Yeah. Hold on. I'm going to try and find that 90 minutes New York to Paris thing. That'd be perfect. Hold on a second. Okay. Here we go.
What's up next? Visit the Liberty Radio Network program guide to find out at shows.lrn.fm. That's shows.lrn.fm.
To be a part of the show, call 602-264-2800. 602-264-2800. And now, Ernest Hancock.
His dream's in sight. You've got to admit it at this point in time. That it's clear. The future looks bright.
From New York to Paris. I remember this song. You know, and I always thought of it. And that's it. What a beautiful world this would be. You know, that is, you know, the criteria right there. When they get 90 minutes New York to Paris, we're there, we win. Yay! I mean, what do you think, Michael? You remember this song? Are you familiar with this concept?
Oh, yeah. This is the promise of supersonic travel, and now with spaceflight, there's the idea of hypersonic travel. In other words, 5 times and more the speed of sound. I mean, this is a dream, right? Point-to-point travel anywhere on the planet is possible if you just leave the atmosphere. And whatever speed you're going at when you leave, that's the speed you stay at until you re-enter. So there's no more energy required. You just got to slow down when you come back in. And that's where some folks see all this so-called space tourism going, with these suborbital rocket-powered airplanes that, if they just keep getting better and bigger and faster, well, hey, that could be used for transportation, not just for joyriding.
Well, it's more than, you know, just it's a joyride that, you know, I might as well get a joyride because I wanted to go to Sydney anyway, you know? So
yeah. You
get in L.A. and boom, I'm in Sydney in 90 minutes. Okay. So this is, and of course, you know, we have the military out there doing their scramjet drone. We got to go bomb somebody. But, you know, how about not? How about we, you know, do the peace thing? And this is a lot closer than I think people. Tell us about the Lynx project, you know, what they're doing there. You're saying Brian went over, you know, from scaled composites, and he said, you know, I'm over here now. You know, what's that about?
Yeah, that's really interesting. So X-Corps Aerospace has been at this as you know, pretty much as long as Scaled has. It's just they haven't had the money. So this is what a space program looks like with some dedicated engineers with a lot of talent who have to raise money as they go. And they've done an amazing job. So they've been building piece by piece all the parts they need to make their suborbital rocket plane. Eventually, they want to go to orbit, too. But they're doing things like selling, you know, low-cost propellant pumps and cryogenic pumps to other customers, you know, other aerospace companies, things like that. And they get a contract for that. It helps them build a piece of their vehicle, and then they get funding to keep going. Now they're there. They got the vehicle coming together on their shop floor. And like I say, Brian Binney, who was the test pilot at Scaled Composites, who won the X Prize in 2004, he's going, okay, these guys look like they're about ready to go. Let me just walk down the flight line here. They're both at the Mojave Air and Spaceport, and now he's signed on with X-Corps. So,
you know, I got to talk to Brian when he flew White Knight, when Michael Melville is his name.
Yeah, Mike Melville.
Yeah, when Mike did the first flight in a human without government money into space, we were there when that happened. And so Brian's in the hangar, and we got a chance to talk with him. And he definitely, I think he's a man of faith. I think he's Catholic, as I remember. You know, he's a man of faith, as I recall. He was wearing a American flag kind of bomber jacket. He's very, you know, America, okay? And the conversation that we had, I'm going, look, do you think, the reason we're here, you want to know who we were and everything, I go, because we understand that government does not want us free enough that we can just leave. They're like, oh, I'm sorry. Do you have your permission slip? And the questioning, you know, going back and forth, kind of, well, you just don't want anybody to just be able to lie. Yeah, I do. That's kind of my point. So I'm wondering if these guys, their attitude over the years has changed as the restrictions in government and permission slips and all this kind of stuff goes. Are they starting to see that that is not the direction this should go? Or do you think they're looking, America should have some kind of a leash on people or something? I mean, what do you think? I mean, you talk to these guys.
Yeah, I think they're pretty anti-restriction, too. I mean, they really chafed at all the regulations they needed to clear to. Well, first of all, there weren't clear regulations. That's part of their beef with getting Spaceship One off the ground. There weren't clear regulations or rules about how they could fly this thing or what kind of rule it would fall under, whether it's an experimental vehicle, whether it's a spaceship or an aircraft.
And I'd say there wasn't a rule. That's the best part. Let me know how it works out.
They were saying they weren't going to let them fly. The FAA was saying you can't fly unless you know. The thing they wanted to do was make them demonstrate that they wouldn't hit anybody on the ground. Okay, we'll let you risk your own neck, but we got to make sure there's no possible way you can hit anyone on the ground if you crash, which, you know, that's a standard that, you know, seems maybe a little bit different from other experimental aircraft that fly. They want to regulate it as basically a missile, right? So that caused them some problems when they were doing their flight profiles coming back in on those space flights. They had to come in within a really narrow window. It was like a 2-mile box or something coming back in. And basically, they ended up with, okay, we'll do the best we can, you know. Who's going to be able to stop us anyway? It wasn't quite that direct to the FAA, but it was like, listen, you guys, we can't wait for you to get your act together. We got to win this thing by the end of the year. We can't wait around. You know, we'll do our best.
You know, there was a regulator, I can't remember who it was, I had on, and I'm going, okay, so they go to Mexico and do it. Ah! You're a U.S. citizen, and we rule you, and you're not allowed, and you're our livestock. I mean, that was their attitude. And I'm going, man, is it that bad? Yeah. You know,
It isn't. Like, you look at what's happening with drones, right? The FAA wants to say they have just all jurisdiction over every drone that flies anywhere. And you're talking about something that might be, you know, 10 feet off the ground. That seems kind of silly, right? So what's happening is, I mean, obviously, it's not workable and it's not enforceable. So people are out there running businesses based on flying drones. Like just about every major Hollywood film you see these days has cameras from drone flights, you know, and it's just kind of like, okay, well, we're doing this, and no one's stopping us, so we'll just keep on doing it. So
well, they have to stop them. They got to make an example. They'll just, you know, some grandmother bought it for her 12-year-old kid, and she's responsible in doing 10 years. I mean, you know, it's going to be something. You know, that's how they operate, is with fear. And I'm going, so if we have that kind of suppression that goes on in the United States, is there a competitive jurisdiction or country or we got to freaking go to Russia to go to the space station again, or create our own space station? What do you see the future as?
Yeah, that's actually a good example with Russia. That's why space tourists have left from Russia. Well, now there's no American spacecraft that can reach the space station at this moment, so there's that. But even before that, people wanted to fly, American space tourists wanted to fly on the shuttle, and there was just no way it was ever going to happen. The government would never let them do that. And so that's why they had to go to Russia, which was a less restrictive environment for that commercial activity, which is ironic because the U.S. won the space race in the 60s. You know, and the line about that was, well, we're going to prove that the capitalist system is better than the communist one. And now the Russians are out capital.
When that was going on, there was legitimate people up there with their shiny badges criticizing Russia for selling space rides. I'm going, are you freaking kidding me? Do you even understand how stupid you sound? You know? And they didn't care. So I'm wondering, you know, the future of space flight and exploration and travel and humanity marches on. And, we'll get back with Elon Musk and SpaceX. And, you know, he wants to die on Mars, preferably not on impact. Maybe he might even come back. Talk about that. Michael Belfore. Go get his newsletter. We'll be right back.
Ross Ulbricht was a...
How come I didn't know about this newsletter thing?
I'm pretty lax about that. I go through spurts where I send it out pretty regularly, and then I'll go for a while without, you know, a few
I don't care. I don't got to have it. You know what I mean? I don't want you just keeping a schedule just to BS me anyway. I mean, if I get something from Mike, I'm going, hey, I should read that, you know? are things happening quickly? Are you excited about what's going on?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this year... I'm going to be writing a lot about X-Core, I expect, and SpaceX, of course, although it's difficult now to get in the door there. I mean, I've been trying since February to get to their test flight facility in Texas, and it's really challenging now because they're a big company now.
Well, I mean, why? They don't love you no more?
There's handlers and people in between now. It used to be I could just walk in the door and Elon would turn me loose with my camera on the shop floor. It was amazing. Now it's not a shop floor, it's a factory, and he's got like four PR people running interference, and he's also running Tesla Motors, so he's getting tons of press interest now, much more than he used to. So he's
Least 1 to 2 stories a day of him doing something. You know, there's always something. You know, one that most recent was lifetime warranty on your Model S car. And I'm going, you know, and free fuel. And I mean, you know, the industry's got to be going, you know, it's a Tucker car thing. You know, they don't like this none too much. It's going to cost them way too much to even be on parity. You know, I don't know that I fear for safety. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? But it's also really cool because he's also working with Solar City. That's one of his big investments. And now there's a partnership between Solar City and Tesla where you can get a home backup, battery backup to go with your solar system. So now it might actually be possible to get off the grid.
Okay, wait. Now, is the car the storage for the solar thing? Or you're saying they're taking the technology, the lithium, and they're just going to manufacture the batteries from Tesla to go into Solar City?
Right. They're taking a separate battery pack made with Tesla batteries that would go in your house. It would be really good idea if you could actually plug your car into your home electrical system. They don't have that.
Well, they are. I mean, that's what I anticipated, is your solar backup is your freaking car, because when do you want to use your electricity anyway? When you're home and your car's in the garage. You know, so, and it's plugged in. So, I mean, I see that coming anyway. You know, people are going to have two cars, and if anybody's mom's home, they got the battery backup of the something. Yeah, this is happening. And I see, you know, when you free it, just yesterday, I do this every weekend, or I'm off, or, you know, whatever. I'll sit down and go, it's kind of a negative Newsday. So what do? I go in and I go communication, transportation, energy, space travel and exploration, and I just go to the news and pick, and I go, yep, and there's Elon all the time on just about every category.
Right.
You know? Right. So we'll talk Elon when we come back. Let's see if I got another good. Let's see. Not lucky you are back in the USSR. Yeah, maybe. That'd be good. All right, here we go.
If you enjoy LRN.FM, please contribute to your favorite shows via their websites and become an amplifier at amp.lrn.fm. That's amp.lrn.fm.
Rhodes? It's the Ernest Hancock Show. Where we're going, there aren't any roads.
You don't know how lucky you are, boy. Back in the U.S., back in the U.S., back in the USSR.
Okay, well, maybe Russia.
Well,
all right. So, Russia. You know, the point is that we would make fun of them, you know, for, oh, look, collectivism doesn't work, and communism is bad, and American free and capitalism and everything, and you go to Russia, hey, they're like selling space rides and stuff. That's like something. You know, we don't like it. You know, who's we? You know, Michael Belfiore, you know, let's go ahead and get his name, you know, spelled here, because I want you to go get his newsletter. Because, like he said, you know, off air, he goes, yeah, I don't do it all every day. Kind of good. You know, when it's some coup, like SpaceX landing their first stage, you know, coming back, going to save me a bunch of money, that's going to be gig. Now, they just done it on the water. You know, they haven't actually, you know, the man's like, we're not really sure. You show us that you can. So they put it on the water, and then it flops over. But Michael Belfiore, Belfiore. Go check out his newsletter sign. I just did it today. One less thing. I got to keep checking on him. And I go, hey, what's Michael doing? I go, check. You know, he has a newsletter. We should do that. So you guys want to say anything about pimping your newsletter there, Michael?
Oh, sure. Yeah, just go to my website, sign up for it. I won't spam you. I won't try to sell you stuff. It's just when cool stuff is happening, or well, like when I'm on the radio, like today, I put out a shout, you know, hey guys, tune in, here's the link, that kind of thing. And you can unsubscribe anytime.
Cool stuff. You know, the we're talking off here, we're going to go to Elon Musk here, SpaceX, Solar City, Tesla Motors. I mean, a lot of people don't see how a lot of this stuff overlaps. You know, I mean, here we have SpaceX that, you know, lots of cool stuff, but you have Tesla Motors that not only he just announced that he's going to give a lifetime warranty on his cars. You don't pay for fuel. You get it and you can go to their super state and charge your car and go get a sandwich, come out, done. You know, 20 minutes, you're done. It's charged and you're done. You know, a few hundred miles, are done. And the Model S beats Vipers and Corvettes. I mean, you put it on the drag strip, boom, I win. You know, a lot of people don't know that. They're going, and they definitely aren't advertising it on Chevrolet commercials. So what happens is then you have the battery packs. He's going to be doing gigafactories. He's got, I got to make, where am I going to put? Kind of, you know, that's a whole different political thing. So he starts making batteries. Now you have Solar City, which is, tell us about Solar City. That's with his cousin or something? How does that work out?
Yeah, I don't know all the ins and outs of the leadership. I know that Elon Musk has had a vested interest in it, though, for a long time, many years. And it's all part of his overall vision for the future, which is that we all live off of solar power and we drive off of solar power, as well as push outward into the solar system. It's this whole overreaching vision that drives everything he's doing. And
you know, in Iron Man 2, 3 or something, there was a cameo appearance he did in a restaurant where he goes to Tony Stark. He says, hey, I'm working on an electric jet. Hey, let's do that. You know, I mean, is he serious?
Yeah, exactly. No, not the electric jet, but this Hyperloop idea he has, that's definitely in sort of along those lines. Solar powered, of course, he'd want it to be. That one's really far out there. I don't know if that's going to work on big scale because of all the
government
would have to run through, but it's basically a vacuum tube or a near vacuum tube through which a train would run and could go almost supersonic.
Well, you see, this is the same thing that Spaceship One Rattan had the problem with, is, hey, man, I'm in space. Can I go? No, you're not allowed. As a part, you know, the same kind of idea that, hey, it's underground. How deep do I got to go before you have jurisdiction? To the core! It belongs to us! I mean, you see, it's the same thing.
That's actually above ground, which even maybe even be more problematic, because you'd have to have this elevated line going across all these jurisdictions and property and all kinds of stuff from L.A. to San Francisco.
Dig a tunnel.
But instead of putting in the ground, yeah. I mean, when you got a vision and you say why not rather than why, then things can happen, and that's what's happening with Elon Musk. There's, of course, a lot of naysayers out there. Bert Rutan used to call NASA naysay. For that reason.
You know, I can't even... I'm shocked that I haven't thought of that. Naysay.
That's right.
Okay, so tell us about Solar City and the battery thing that you're talking about.
Yeah, so this is cool. So because Solar City and Tesla Motors are linked, now you've got the biggest problem with getting off the grid with solar power is storage, like energy storage. How are you going to run at night? How are you going to run when it's cloudy? There haven't been good enough batteries to store that energy so you can just keep on running. And that's the same problem cars have faced, electric cars. And that's the one that Tesla Motors has solved or is in the process of solving. And more importantly, to solve it at a price point that can really make it widespread. He's got it licked for the Model S now, but that's a $50,000 to $100,000 car. But now they're driving down the cost, and like you say, he wants to build this massive factory. He calls it the Gigafactory. That would drop the price of these battery cells, lithium-ion batteries, by at least 30%. That's his goal, and crank them out in huge quantities.
Okay, now, wait. Say that again. He wanted to reduce the cost by 30%. Is that what you said?
Yeah, of lithium-ion battery packs, because he's got the technology now, but it's still too expensive for wide use. I mean, most people.
You know, the one thing that I was interested in, because we were doing our own carbon thing here, is that... he sees carbon nanotubes along with as a supercapacitor battery that even new technology past lithium make. I'm wondering if his factory is going to be able to incorporate new developments in technology. Is he talking about that?
Yeah, he says he can adapt to any chemistry that comes along, but he sees right now what's out there now is the right one for now.
Okay.
So we'll see. But for now, he thinks he can do it with existing technology and drop the price significantly. And so now Solar City is already only in the state of California because they're pushing against regulations and, you know, all kinds of stuff in all the other states. They're going to have to fight a state-by-state battle just as they are with selling the cars. But right now in California, you can buy a Tesla-made battery pack to go with your Solar City solar panel installation.
Right now. You can do this now.
Yeah. Well, actually, no. Almost. I think it's right now they're marketing it to businesses, and residential use is coming. I think that's what it says on their website. You'd have to check right now, solarcity.com, I believe, for the latest on that. But that's where they're going with this. So you buy a battery pack to go with your installation, which is a really cool business model. Actually, their goal is to make it so you don't pay for the solar panels. They're the ones who pioneered this idea. You call them up, and their finance department is just as creative as their engineering department. The engineering department goes, okay, what do you need? What's your site like? How much power do you need? And then they take that number to their finance department, and they work with you to figure out, okay, are we going to lease it to you? Are you going to finance it? Are you going to buy it outright? Such that your monthly payment is less than you pay now for electric from the grid.
But no, both my daughter and her husband and my son and his wife have gotten solar panels on. I don't think they did Solar City. It might have been another one, but they don't pay. I mean, you know, they
yeah.
It's like $300-$400. I mean, you know, here in Arizona, the air conditioning, I mean, you know, and a few hundred dollars. And then all of a sudden now it's $200 for one. My son, what he did is he had the purchase price. I think he purchased it and he got, because he had a bunch of equity in his home, he had it rolled into that. So it's only like $90-something a month that he pays for all his electric now, because he had it rolled into his mortgage. $90 a month in Phoenix for electric bill. And I have another friend, and he didn't have to, you know, have any money up front. We have other friends in Sun City. It is going stupid in retirement communities, because they understand, you go, wait a minute, I don't get electric bill, but what's the state doing here, the utilities? Well, they want to charge, they want to, you know, penalize, they want to something, you know? So there's interest against them doing this. Where's that coming from?
Yeah, well, there's utilities. There's a lot of, you know, infrastructure there and a lot of money going into this bill. You know, you're throwing away money every month. But if you own your own means of production, and especially if you got a good battery on there, then, man, you could maybe just get off the grid, you know, run a few things at night, maybe dial back your use a little bit. when the sun isn't shining.
That was the first thing that they did, is they put more insulation in. They, you know, do this tree thing. They kind of, you know, whatever, they got it. And all of a sudden, boom, you know, it just, we can make you self-sustaining. The other thing is, when we come back, we'll focus on this a little bit more, is the batteries. Because the battery in the car, your car becomes your storage. Let's say you got two Model S's. One, somebody goes to work. The other person, when do you want to have the battery, you know, available for your solar power kind of whatever anyway, when you're home and the car's in the garage, being the storage for your solar panels. So all of a sudden, Tesla cars is the storage for solar power, solar city panels.
When it comes to investing in precious metals, you need a source you can trust who offers you choices and empowers you to maximize your wealth. That's where Roberts & Roberts Brokerage can help. Roberts & Roberts is a trusted name in precious metals. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts has been providing you with the finest gold and silver bullion, coins, rounds, and bars at genuine and honest prices. They make it easy to invest in precious metals and work with you to suit your investment needs. In addition to offering gold and silver for sale for U.S. dollars, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage is now accepting Bitcoin in exchange for their quality precious metals products. To speak with a professional from Roberts & Roberts about investing in precious metals, call toll-free 800-874-9760. Write this number down, 800-874-9760. Visit Roberts & Roberts online at rrbi.co. That's rrbi.co. On behalf of Roberts & Roberts, here's hoping your day is as good as gold.
Okay, in the last segment here, we start in a couple minutes. Is there anything you want to make sure we cover?
I think, just keep an eye on xcoreaerospace.com and spacex.com for space stuff. Those are where a lot of the stuff's happening right now, those two companies.
Is there, when you talk about, Elon is so... His demeanor is like, tries not to be offensive. He kind of, he stutters. It makes him kind of, seem, not threatening. He goes into congressional and he's like, golly shuck and gee willikers, why the hell is the, Lockheed and Boeing, these guys getting all this stuff that they're spending taxpayer money, duh. And there has to be opposition to, and him just being so nice and sweet and kind of, innovative and everything, going, damn it, we hate that. I mean, that's like the worst thing that could happen to the military industrial, we rule you people.
Yeah. Yeah. But if he just got past certification, though, from the Air Force to fly their cargo. So that was a big deal.
Yeah. Damn it. Well, how do you squeeze by? All right. We'll talk about it. Here we go.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock here in Phoenix, Arizona. I am from the BEA People Studios of Freedoms with an S, freedomsphoenix.org. Michael Belfiore, BELFIORE. Go get his newsletter. And he won't bug the crap out of you. He pinky swears. Okay, and what'll happen is you'll get updated on all the cool stuff. Now, one of the things that was in the news here recently, in addition to, all the stuff that Elon's got a lot of irons in the fire. A lot of smart guys. A lot of just head down, plow, focus, and he was on the verge of it almost went away, and he things just started clicking, and he made some money. Now stock is going up, 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 and then, look, his stock went down a day. And it's like big news, and all his supporters don't care, okay? So they see where the future's going. This is kind of like an Apple thing, man. This is like an IBM in the early days kind of deal. This is, the future be a-coming. And the thing is that there was a contract that they do for putting up military satellites and all kinds of different government stuff. And Elon was like, look, man, not only did we surpass these guys, we've, check off a bunch of boxes that they didn't have to check off, and we're doing kind of, and how come we didn't get these contracts and you're wasting taxpayer money? And there were hearings on this. Tell us what you know about that, Michael.
Oh, yeah. So this group, Boeing and Lockheed Martin, have this partnership. They used to be competitors supplying launches to the U.S. Air Force. Then they formed a joint company, ULA, United Launch Alliance, and now there's no competition getting these Air Force satellites up. And they've had a nice, cozy deal there for quite a while. And then Elon came along with SpaceX and went, wait a sec, guys, let's not have no competition. Let's have another player in the mix. And by the way, one that doesn't rely on Russian engines, because those guys are actually sourcing their engines from Russia, which is really kind of embarrassing.
You can't
given
make
the fact
this stuff
that,
up. I mean, seriously.
The government wants to do sanctions on Putin and all this stuff, and yet they're buying hardware for their spy sats, their military hardware from Russia. It just makes no sense. And so Elon gets in front of Congress and he explains this, and he says, look, you know, and he filed a lawsuit. And, you know, he's in the process now of pushing that through where he can actually be in the running for these launches, which he says he can do for something like 25% of the cost of the other guys.
Oh, hell no. I mean, that's exactly what they were trying to avoid.
Oh, yeah.
With their Russian
engines. That's right. That's right.
So
he's got them scrambling, and I think it's going to happen. They're going to have to. It's the same thing as what's going on with the big, space launch system that NASA is building for billions and billions of dollars. That it doesn't really do anything more than a SpaceX vehicle could. If Elon Musk gets it to do what he says it can, and I think he will get there. You know, fly seven astronauts. On some kind of system,
his Dragon space capsule.
Yeah, he just unveiled the manned version of that. He's been flying cargo for a couple of years now to the space station in a fully pressurized vehicle that was always designed from the beginning with people in mind. Now he's just adding windows and some control systems. And now it's going to be really clear really soon here, if it isn't already, that, hey, this thing is way cheaper and more reliable than this big billion-dollar boondoggle that we've Congress actually mandated that Congress spend money on this new system.
It's just that welfare for, old, nobody cares about anymore. Everybody, all the good guys and young guys left to go to the private whatever, so the government say they kind of sort of have a finger in that. What did Bert call them?
Naysay.
That's right. Naysay. Yeah, naysay. Yeah, that is my new name for them. Thank you very much.
to be totally straightforward, it's not entirely NASA's fault, because Congress actually mandated that they have to spend money on this big system that's gobbling up most of their manned spaceflight budget. They're required by law to do it.
Yeah, but I mean, if somebody gave me a bunch of money to do something, I go, okay, well, I can make something decent, make lemonade out of it or something. But I mean, here comes SpaceX, and they go, no, we're good. Because these things are not made to do what they're really, the PR says it to do. They're there to just make somebody money. They're for contributions. They're for, some state program of congressional in my district kind of crap. It has nothing to do with what, certainly the free market would want to have it do, is like actually provide a service for somebody willing to voluntarily pay for it.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So it's going to be really interesting here now. They're up for contracts right now. SpaceX, Boeing, and a company called Sierra Nevada Corporation. They're all up for these manned spaceflight contracts, commercial contracts to service the space station. So it's going to be really interesting to see if SpaceX gets that money. They are the clear technical leader in this, and the only one of the three actually regularly sending spaceships to the International Space Station.
Well, who's the Sierra group? Who are they?
Sierra Nevada is the company that bought SpaceDev, which collaborated with Scaled on the Spaceship One rocket motor.
Really?
So their space division, which now includes what was SpaceDev, is now in the running for these commercial contracts. And they're using an old NASA design for a lifting body vehicle that was originally designed as a lifeboat from the space station. Now they're turning it into a reusable space plane that they're putting in competition here for these commercial crew contracts.
Well, it just sits on a large rocket and then just wings back?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Does it first stage land?
First stage does not land. It's just the rocket comes, the spacecraft comes back.
Right. It's almost not fair. I remember there's recently they had
what was it, a commercial that has these two Gillette razors going on an uneven surface. You know, it's just a ball technology. It stays on your face more, whatever. And they made a comment. They go, at what point does the mercy rule apply?
Right.
It's like, you know, come on, just, you know, it's embarrassing, you guys trying to compete with SpaceX. So this is, how's the Mars thing coming? You know, is this all progression towards that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So Elon Musk has his vision from the beginning to get to Mars, right from day one. That was his plan. So everything he's doing is in that direction. And not just do a one-shot, you know, boots and footprints and flags and then come back. He wants to enable settlement. He figures, okay, it's going to take you 6 months to get there at minimum, each and then back. So let's, why not just have it be a one-way trip, have it be a migration. And he has this vision of you'd spend $500,000 for the trip, and you can homestead there.
You know, and I picked this hemisphere right here. That's mine.
That's right.
You know, and you know that's going to happen. They're going to go, no. You're not allowed. There's got a flag. You got to have a flag of a special kind. It can't be corporate. Got to have a jurisdiction of over the earth of some kind of flag and an army of flag. I mean, I know how these guys think, man. They're messed up in the head. So there's some United Nations liaison wanting to have a conversation with Elon.
I don't know if it's gotten to that point yet. I mean,
this
is interesting. It's an interesting pattern with him. If everyone goes, oh, there's no way. Yeah, that's not going to happen until he does it. And they go, oh, okay, well, that's, this next thing isn't going to happen. And then so far he's proved them wrong. He's proved the naysayers wrong all this time.
Because his napkin said so. I mean, literally, he goes, let me see. You get a pencil, a napkin. I go, yes, I can do it. Let's go do it. And they go, yeah, but you're not allowed, you know? I see it's always been throughout history. It's always been people like that. And right when you think that couldn't happen anymore, and where are these mavericks that are doing, you know, here comes the mild-mannered, kind of stuttering, good-looking, young, got his own family, Elon Musk. I mean, you know, it's always something like this, and it just blindsides the bad guys. And I'm glad that you're in the middle of this, keeping us up to speed on this. This is awesome. You know, so I'm glad I got the newsletter, Michael Belfiore, Belfiore, so that you don't have to, you know, sporadically, you know, wait for me to tell you. Michael can tell you. You know, hold on, we're going to go in the break here in a little bit. I want to get a little bit more from you. But go ahead, you know, as we're going to the last minute here, tell the people, you know, what are the other high-tech things that you should be looking for in robotics and exoskeletons and cars and battery. You know, give us some of the peak of your mind, what's going on.
Okay, well, besides space, robots, you mentioned are really huge. Look for the Robotics Challenge, robotics challenge.org. It's coming next year to the LA Convention Center, LA Fairgrounds in California, and that's going to be really a big deal.
Is that open to anybody, or you pay the $300 I get to see it fee, or is that just press?
No, it's open. It's open to spectators. You know, they picked a big venue, so lots of people can go and watch if they want.
Okay, I'm going to put in for, you know, press credentials. Help me out here. I can say, I know Michael. Michael, he said I can. We're going to work on it, see if we can get in there. We always go to the CES, Consumer Electronics Show, but I'd rather go to this. There we go. Okay, go ahead and tell me, Donna's going to put that up in the third hour. What's the dates of that?
Okay, let me just quickly check. I think it's June, but let me check. It's roboticschallenge.org.
So what's going to be their challenge? I mean, what's the main competition? Who can, you know, beat up a sumo wrestler or what?
Yeah, no, it's these humanoid robots that are going to try to do disaster recovery activities.
Well, that's kind of what they did before, right?
Yeah, it's the extension of that same event. So last year was the trials from which they selected the ones going to the finals.
And
there's going to be new challengers as well.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I mean, between then and now, hell, you got freaking Optimus Prime ready to go, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's going to be interesting. And that is the future. I think we're going to see more of these robots and more of our environments, not just in factories and places like that. They're going to be walking around on the streets.
Yeah, you know, the one thing that I saw that was, it was a concern of mine, and I just kind of, you know, felt kind of weird about, you know, robot, and it was when they put the eyes on the display for the head, that where the eyes were going, that you could see which way it was going to move.
Oh yeah, that was the Baxter robot.
Yeah, so when they did that, and I saw, I go, what a unique way of, you know, having a interface. And then, of course, when it hits, comes up against resistance, you program that in, it's more safe, you know, it's a better environment. But what happens is all that is software that can be changed, manipulated, hacked by a 13-year-old, and it goes on a killing spree. I mean, you know, this is, and that's one thing that Elon was saying. He's going, look, artificial intelligence is one, we got to worry about this. This is going to be like a bigger threat than nukes.
Yeah, that's a legitimate concern, I think.
I mean, think so,
at
too.
At the moment, not so much, but once these things become more prevalent and more powerful and everything else, yeah, and you know they're going to use them in military applications.
Hell yeah!
As well.
They, them, those, they're going, you know, problem solved. We already doing this drone joystick Nevada to Yemen crap. You know, what happens when that thing goes in, it does the transformer thing, and it starts walking around blasting people, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, don't think that won't happen. I mean, they'll do it just so they just terrorize people because they, them, those are scumbags. You know, I can see this happening if it's not already planned. You know, this is maybe they already got. See, that's one thing about DARPA. You know, you're the guy to ask on this. As you did the Mad Scientist book and all this kind of stuff, oftentimes what they have here depicted and kind of, it's almost like a psyop. They're already 10 years ahead in DARPA lab. They already got it made. They're just trying to condition us to put it on the street or something.
Yeah, that's what DARPA does. They create the technology and then they hand it off to someone else to try to make it stick. Like self-driving cars is an example of that. They did that back in the, you know, late 2000s. And now they're starting to come into production. So that's,
well, that was for what? For military convoys or something?
Yeah, that was the impetus. Everything DARPA does is for the military. A lot of it trickles out to civilian use, like the internet. But this was one of those where they wanted to protect supply convoys and not put people in harm's way driving them. So they figured, well, if a car could, or a truck could drive itself from GPS waypoint to GPS waypoint autonomously, then we wouldn't have to put someone at risk in the car.
Yeah, I don't think they give a crap about, you know, a soldier, other than, you know, how much he cost, or, you know, disability, or they got to deal with medical, or they blah blah blah. I mean, it's a numbers money game for these military guys. And the thing is that, you know, they'll use that as an excuse to be able to have an autonomous, you know, I got, you know, supply trucks my ass, is to be able to bring in the heavy we rule you crap.
Yeah, certainly that's a possibility now. You put armaments on it, just the way they did with drones. You know, drones started out that way, just flying from waypoint to waypoint. Well, you could just easily put a weapon on there as a camera at this point.
Well, I remember the robots that they were going after. Oh, we got to get the IED. We got to this. Got in the track of the kind of, yeah, and you just knew a 50 caliber is going to go on that, you know. So this is, I'm not feeling warm and fuzzy about this. And as you look at what's going on here in the U.S., well, you know, the civil unrest kind of thing, and then all of a sudden they're bringing in the MRAP. I'm going, are you freaking kidding me? You know, this is in the sonic, everything. I'm just, that's why I like having you on to keep us, I try and, you know, cast it in a positive light. There's a lot of good that can come out of this. It's going to benefit humanity, but, you know, and it's not, you know, like guys like Elon and so on that are doing this out of the curiosity and the scientific, you know, ability just to create cool stuff because he can, you know. But the other guys, they'll take this and just twist it into ew. So, I need you to...
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I mean, it's just an interesting time in history. I think we're building that we've had for a long time, the means of our own destruction. And the only way out of that is to mature enough as a species to go, hey, you know, we're all good here. Let's not use this on each other. Let's use it to explore and learn about the universe and all that.
Yeah, I'm. There's a lot of just in. I'm really glad that you made time for us now, because over the last couple of weeks, I've just been in a funk. I mean, you know, just I'm a real optimistic kind of guy, and looking, I'm just going, man, I used to always say, I go, can we hurry up and get to a police state so we can leave? You know, and I'm like, you know, but then you have to get to a police state, and it's kind of, you're like there, and I can feel it, you know, it's like a serenity thing. I'm, you know, into the black and I ain't coming back kind of bite me thing. And I just can see that this mentality of, you know, here they cut this oppressive, you know, cloak of wool blanket over innovation of the young kind of, I just feel the attempt. And people like Elon and what you're doing and the writing, it kind of provides a path out. You know, we can get off the grid, but I think that's what threatens they, them, those. The ones that benefit from our being, they get a cut of everything when you start growing your own tomatoes. You know, you got your own power. You got your own electrical car. You got your, you start extracting yourself from the grid. Oh my goodness, you use, you know, Bitcoin in your financial transactions. They definitely don't like crap like that. So I'm just going, I see this extraction of humanity from, you know, the leash, you know, of they, them, those. As that happens, they diminish in their. I don't even have to beat them. I just have to ignore them. And they don't. Man, the bad guys don't like being ignored.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It's threatening to a lot of these vested interests. But I think it's inevitable. I mean, sure, they're pushing back against Tesla, but they're still managing to sell to customers. They're selling as many cars as they can possibly pump out.
I know, that just pisses them off.
Solar Cities and a lot of other companies now are rolling out these power, you know, systems that don't require any money, you know, from the homeowner. I mean, I'd like to see them get them out to renters. You know, that's a whole other issue.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of this is kind of elitist. I mean, who can afford a Model S or even an X or even the next one, you know, the 3? It's still going to be an expensive car. Like somebody who can only afford a low end car isn't going to be able to do that. I think there needs to be, and I don't think Elon's doing enough to address that. And that's the vast majority of people out there who don't have a big income.
You well, know, I tell you where this overlaps is when you're having to do a $8,000 to $15,000 battery bank, and all of a sudden that's half the cost of the next car day lot, and it doubles as your battery storage and your car, all of a sudden things change.
Yeah, and his competitors are going to push him that direction too. Like Nissan is really interesting to me. They have the Leaf. It's the best, most affordable electric car, and they're trying to keep costs down. And they just demoed a house system that's powered by the car itself. So they're thinking
really
along these lines. Yeah, I just came across that. It was a Forbes article. That was published actually a couple years ago now. But so they're thinking about this idea.
Yeah, I think we ran that story. I know that, you know, just the concept, the idea of using your car as the battery storage, I'm going, well, of course, you know. But
yeah.
I'm just waiting for it. Then when you got Solar City, you know, and Tesla, I'm like, you know. But they're thinking in the terms of using their factory. We got battery packs that, you know, bolt on the bottom plate of the car, and then we create these boxes. I mean, you know, I can understand why you'd have the option to do both, but I can see where they integrate.
Yeah.
And then they'll have an antitrust, some law you're breaking. You're not allowed to have the this as an incentive to buy or a coupon discount to get this and get that, and you're not allowed because you're not allowed. You know, I can see that coming.
Yeah. And I think, too, this is always a problem with energy efficiency with renters, that it's because it's the renter that pays for the energy and not the landlord. There's no end, but the landlord needs to pay for infrastructure. It's always been a problem. Like people in apartments with low-end fridges that just guzzle power all the time, you know, these 20-year-old machines that keep going, but they're sucking down all the energy. That's the kind of thing we need to address if we're going to really get widespread adoption of solar.
Yeah, there's so many economic things that are coming that we've been predicting, too. I see here in Arizona, you know, it's the most job loss. I mean, it's all kind of, you look at a lot of stats and such. And what's going to happen is the real estate's going to take a dump again. And when it does, you know, Donna and I may, you know, purchase some land and start trying to, because we do the aquaponics and the chicken, and then, you know, we have, you know, fish, and we do solar. We have a HOPE system. You know, it's a H2OPE, water purification and energy. So it's a solar water pumping purification back cool thing. And we do all this stuff to learn this technology so that as we're going, okay, and pull the trigger. And we're, you know, just waiting for the next drop in real estate, which I think is imminent. And when that happens, we may be able to pick up some land here that's on a lot of water that we'll go ahead and here we go. But I see this kind of technology. The reason, one of the motivations for me to keep up on this is because I want to do it. You know, I mean, I'm going to need to do it and try and maintain a quality standard of living as I get older. I just, look, man, I don't want to be too hot, too cold, too hungry, too thirsty, too something, too wet, too dry. I'm just, you know, I just want to be left alone. Well, we got to have technology to do that. And a good friend of mine, I think I've told you before, he works out at the nuke plant out there. He's been 12 years off grid totally. You know, and so the boy's got skills. And so we already know it can be done. It's just, you know, how economically you can do it. And, oh, by the way, my battery bank comes with four wheels and I can drive it. Okay, cool. I can do that. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's where I want to go, too. Definitely.
Well,
now it's stuff you can buy off the shelf. That's the cool thing. You don't have to be such a tinkerer and a hobbyist for a lot of this stuff now. You just call a company.
You know, they have, they do these different, what do they call them, like Prepper Fest or Preparedness Expos and all, you know, that kind of thing that we go to and we'll set up our booths and so on. And we built the geodesic domes to put our aquaponics thing in. And what happened was, let's see, I can show part of it. Go to camera D and do that. At the end of the video, you can see there's part of it. You see the pond, and let's see, that's in the inside of one of the domes. I have a sink in there and vertical growing and all this other crap. But the reason we did that was I could see that the structure itself, I wanted to play with building structures. So we've had some fun coming up with, you know, all kinds of different things that we're experimenting with. But it's always a government thing. You know, well, you're not allowed. You didn't get a permit. You got to have the engineering of the yada, yada, yada. Seriously, I just, you know, it's always something somewhere. I can't. And then you start running in all this Agenda 21 of how you can, the watershed, and it's, you know, government's water that rained on you. I mean, it's just, you know, strange stuff. And I just see the future just bypassing all of these controls, and humanity is not separated by geography or flags. And when you start going to space and you get that overall perspective, that's one thing that changes a lot of people, is seeing that. You know what I mean? It's kind of just an emotional thing. So I'm wondering, as we get a whole bunch of people start going to space, they stop seeing geography as, you know, got a flag. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. That thing, to me, that is probably the biggest value of space right now before we start harvesting resources out there, because it's going to be a long time before we do that in large quantities. But that immediate, sort of, I think of it as spiritual benefit. And Brian Binney talks about that. It was a spiritual experience for a lot of people going up there and looking back down. It changes your perspective and the way you think about your place on planet Earth. And
you know, that may be interesting to see if I can get Brian on the show, you know, because we had met. You know, we have kind of you know, introduction there. He probably remembers me. He's probably still pissed. But the
I can put in a word for you. I just talked with him about, you know, a few days ago. He's at X-Corp now. He's much freer to talk.
Well, see, that's why it would be of interest. It'd give him an opportunity to pimp, you know, X-Corp.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, just between you and me and however many people are listening, he's got a memoir that he's written that he's shopping for a publisher for.
Really?
About the whole Spaceship One experience. And this would be the only insider's account of that. I mean, my book was as close as I could get without actually being in the inside, but he's from the inside.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
He's worked at three companies now. He was at Rotary Rocket before the Spaceship One thing, and then he went to Spaceship, you know, to Scaled, and now he's at X-Corp. So he's been at three of these major ventures trying to make this stuff happen at this point. He's got a really good perspective on it.
Yeah, I tell you, I of all the people that was involved in that and our trip there, he was the one, other than the guy that wanted to represent in Mojave, wanted to get a permit, say he didn't need a permit. You know, Brian was probably the one that stuck in my mind the most. And the reason was, I mean, he was the pilot for White Knight when Michael did his flight, you know.
Yeah.
And he was there kind of, you know, and he, you know, was, I don't know, just in the crowd, and we're standing there holding our signs and stuff. And he engaged us in conversation. And I got the, and it's still, there's a generation, you know, late, you know, older generation. Well, I'm 53, so I guess I was in my 40s, you know, early 40s then. But, you know, there's still these people that still attached our success to a patriotic, nationalistic America kind of thing. And I could feel that with him. And he was proud to be an American, you know, and kind of this. And I can, and I'm going, yeah, I, you know, and I understand what he means, but I could see it was the U.S. government that was going to be the biggest impediment to what he wanted to do. And as he goes over to X Corps, I would talk, you know, I would very, you know, as kindly as possible, see if his perception of government in general has changed. Does he see it as an impediment, as an advantage? Only in America you can do this. Or is he starting to see this mentality, the blooms fell off the rose? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, sure, sure. Yeah, and he's a Gulf War veteran, too, so he's really been in the thick of it.
Yeah, and that's one thing I got from Bert also is that, you know, he did a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, even secretly for the U.S. America. You know, it's kind of like a Tony Stark thing. You kind of come to face-to-face with what you're really supporting, it, and you have a change of heart and you become Iron Man. I mean, you know. So I'm just wondering if Brian's become Iron Man now.
I don't know. It's going to be interesting, though, at X Corps. I mean, this is what gets me fired up because, first of all, they're doing amazing stuff, and they always have. You know, they don't have engine problems the way that Scaled has. It's so interesting because Scaled's an airplane company, and X Corps is an engine company. If only they could have gotten together, you know, they would have been able to, like, they had everything they needed, but they're competitors, so they're
What happened with Spaceship Two? I mean, I thought that they're just, you know, making a bigger engine. I mean, you know, you got more propellant to kind of, you know, go. I mean, what's been their problem?
Well, that's been the plan, but it hasn't worked out so well. I think look, this is speculation because I'm not inside. No one's really talking. But, you know, this solid fuel geometry that they use is inherently unstable in that it doesn't always burn consistently. So even on Spaceship One, they had this off-center thrust a lot of the time. So it doesn't exactly go through the center line. It's more difficult to control it. And I think that's one of the problems. Now that they're scaling it up, they figured, oh, just scale it up, but it doesn't scale so well. So they're having problems keeping it stable for long enough periods to get it up there. And meanwhile, it's spacecraft, like every other aerospace project, has gotten heavier, and they need more power, not less. And it's a limitation, too, of the hybrid technology that it doesn't produce as much thrust per unit of weight. So, meanwhile, at X Corps, they're doing all liquids, and that's the most efficient type of engine. And they've got it controlled. Those engines don't blow up. They're super reliable. They even run them inside their hangar for little ones. They're going to do a test fire. They'll just tell everyone, okay, we're in a fire. Put on your earphones. And, you know, they do it. That's just kind of the way they operate. So, that's not the problem they have on their vehicle, but they are not airplane guys. So they're having to go over that curve, you know, and that's a learning curve.
So their problem is aerodynamics more than it is thrust.
Yeah, they've flown two vehicles so far, and they were both based on existing designs. They just took out the pusher prop in the back of a Long Easy. That was their first one, the Easy rocket, and stuck a rocket engine up there. And now this is the first time they're having to design and build an entirely new aircraft from the ground up. And that's,
well, I just saw a story that they finally just came out with the first part. It's like the skid plate, the lower something. You know, isn't that a story that I remember?
I'm not sure. I don't remember that one. But I do see them, you know, every once in a while they'll announce, okay, now we've got the, you know, the wing struts in. Okay, now we've tested the pressure, you know, what do they call that? The pressure container that becomes the cockpit. And so they're slowly but surely doing it, and they're going to put it together and start test flying it. And so the engines are totally reliable as far as I can tell. I mean, they're just like, nobody does engines like they do at this kind of scale. You know, small ones, big ones, you know, start and stop because they're all about reusability. So they're firing them many, many times, and they've got that down, but now we'll see if their airplane will do what it's supposed to. Meanwhile, just at the same airport, these other guys are having problems with engines. You know, if they could just get one of X Corps' engines, they'd probably have to redesign the airplane around it. But still, I mean, it's a little bit frustrating, you know, to
well,
see.
Well, let me look this up. Lynx space body, because I remember seeing some just in the last couple of weeks that they started having engine parts come out. Let's see. Makers of the body, deep space, you know, so. Lynx body spray. No, probably not. Anyway, I thought I saw something that they were starting to have body parts come out, and I'm going, ew, it was on Freedom's Phoenix. I know I put it up there. But the other thing that I was kind of interested in was the engines that's coming out of SpaceX and the way that they're designing them. When Elon, you know, came up with the, you know, I'm 3D printing from my, I just made, did kind of push button do. How are Lynx making theirs? Who's machining them? Are they doing them there? Or are they using that kind of technology? Are they 3D printing titanium? What's their manufacturing abilities?
It's smaller scale than SpaceX or scaled composites. It's a machine shop. They've got CNC mills, so they are able to do digital design and, you know, fabrication, but they're not doing, as far as I can tell or I know, they're not doing 3D printing, of engine parts the way SpaceX is. That's really a pioneering thing.
That is, you know, I went to Consumer Electronics Show we go each year, and they had gun parts and different things and building, you know, 45s there and so. And I asked him, I said, is this as strong as the metal you get in a forging or other ways of doing it? And they go, it's stronger. And I'm going, okay, pray tell why? Because there's no inclusions. You know, it's like you have titanium powder and the lasers, you know, perfectly melt. And it's just one solid crystalline structure of exact the way that you can design the way the metal, is pure throughout the entire structure. And I'm going, okay. So I guess Elon's feeling comfortable. That's a good way of doing parts, especially when you're doing, you know, one engine at a time. And, oh, my goodness, you get to save them now. So this is... how long are we looking at? Are we looking at leaps and bounds? I mean, are we talking, you know, year, two, three, we're going to start seeing some oh my goodness stuff?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. The digital manufacturing is a whole other field that's just taking off like crazy now. I mean, all the major manufacturers, you know, aerospace companies, GE, you know, engine, cars, everything, they're all moving this way because it's so much easier to retool for new designs. That's one of the advantages. You don't have to build a new robot or a new process on your factory floor. You just have the one machine that prints any type of part you need. So all you have to do is send it a new file. So that's one of the...
Well, it's still the mass production. I mean, you got to have like 15 gazillion printers, you know?
Right.
Which may be, if you get printers printing printers, I mean, I guess problem solved. Yeah. Be like an iRobot, you know, that robot's making robots. Well, that's just stupid.
That's kind of scary. Yeah. Yeah, but I think we're moving, too, to an economy that'll be much more niche-y. You know, it'll be... it'll be economical to do small runs of machines or devices or whatever it is.
But we have that experience with self-publishing. You know, people, you put it up and I don't have to order 10,000 books. I can, do one, five at a time.
Same thing.
Yeah, I can see. I already see how the economics of this work. Oh, it's too expensive. It's not as expensive. I got to do 10,000 of them. It's not that. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
Instead of paying $5 for the book, I got to pay $12. But I can, you know, get it now, and I don't have to worry about some publisher. So, you know, I see, and I need you to help me see it. You know, that's why, you know, you're a big giant add to this, because I don't have the same access that you do on this stuff, except I want to go to, see, that was one thing when they did the Rocket Racing League, the whole point of that, which I thought was, you know, a lot closer and being buddies with Rattan's group, composite over there, that I'm going, Scale Composites was really behind this Rocket Racing League to have the quick refueling of liquid rockets, so that's a X-Wing fighter running up the orbit and back, you know. That was the whole point. They kind of have this, you know, NASCAR pit thing. And has that been abandoned? And that's X-Corps the only one doing that?
Yeah, that didn't work out. I mean, X-Corps was one of the main contractors on that, and also Armadillo Aerospace, which is defunct now, too. That was, you might remember, John Carmack is one of the original X-Prize competitors.
Yeah, for the lander.
Yeah, well, he was in that the competition. They did really well in that. But even before that, the original X Prize, you know, that Scaled Composites was in, they were a contender for that, too.
But, yeah, but they went to the Lander and they got their $5 million there or something, you know, doing
Yeah,
that.
They kind of went off the the track because they started chasing contracts and other stuff, and it didn't work out. But X-Corps is still going strong, and I think part of it is because they've always focused on their mission. So it happened to dovetail, you know, well with the Rocket Racing League, because it's all about reflyable, reusable rocket planes. So they were, you know, that was right up their alley. So they just got right on that.
So what's the future for the Lynx? I mean, they're doing this, so we can say we did, or they think they're going to, you know, make money from people going up playing co-pilot? Are they going to expand it, or is this a demonstration platform? What is the point?
Well, like Elon Musk, they ultimately want to settle space. So they, too, are shooting for that very lofty goal, but without the deep pockets. So that's one thing that's really interesting about them. They're doing it step by step. So the first step is going to be this demonstrator, the Lynx Mark I, which doesn't actually go to that 62-mile, you know, Kármán line to space. It's going to go somewhat lower than that, but that'll demo the technologies for the II, which will then cross that line, and then they're going to put a couple of these together and make an orbital vehicle.
Couple of what together? A couple of engines?
Couple of rocket planes. And they won't tell me the full details of that, except to say that they're both going to be manned. There's going to be two stages. It's going to be a two-stage ship. But it sounds like it's a little bit like it's going to be sort of like a little shuttle. Yeah, kind of thing. Yeah, like only the White Knight will be rocket powered too, you know, not just a turbine. So
okay, well, I'm looking forward to that. And, you know, so this stuff's going to happen quickly, especially with the, you know, the metal 3D printing doing its in my head push the button thing. I mean, I start to come across these kinds of minds. When you see Elon, you know, it's one of those, he's got big processor, go fast, you know, 200 IQ kind of thing. You know, and some motivation and you're just lucky they're being nice to us and not playing Pinky Dr. Evil and divert their attention towards ruling us like all the guys they suck in the DARPA. But, you know, I have a lot of positive energy feeling towards all this stuff, but at the same time, we're in competition with they, them, those are trying to compete with them or suppress them, or and at least they're outing themselves, and that's where I need you to help me.
Yeah, well, that's one reason the suborbital market is interesting, because there isn't one. These guys are creating it. So there's no competition there except for them.
They got a suborbital. It's called their freaking hypersonic drone blow up an hour and a half away Yemen crap.
Yeah, we've got that hypersonic airplane. That's another animal. That's an air breathing engine that the private guys can't touch that. That's like so out there. And they don't need to either. To get a couple people up there, they don't need an air breather. The whole reason they want the air breather for the military is because it can fit on a fighter plane. You don't need all that tankage and stuff and liquid oxygen and all that. You just stick a little cruise missile there.
Yeah, it's just what they call them, ramjet or hyperjet.
Ramjet.
Or
ramjet. Yeah.
Yeah. The technology, we didn't even get into the space station stuff. You know, what kind of habitat advancements there are. Does that come across your radar screen?
Yeah, somewhat. Bigelow Aerospace is still out there. Robert Bigelow, he's still waiting for his customers, you know, to come when they won't come unless there's transportation. So he's a chicken without an egg or an egg without a chicken, whichever way you want to think of it. He can't get his habitats up there without somebody being able to reach them.
Well, I mean, SpaceX has that ability or coming to, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's the hope, that they will be ready within a couple of years or 3 years. And once that's available and once Elon's selling seats to private customers, which he says he can do for $20 million instead of 60 or 70 that the Russians are charging per seat.
Well, I can see Bigelow. Then, they just go do the trailer park at LaGrange 1 or something, and you're done. You got a place to go.
Yeah. Well, you got to get up there. Yeah. Well, you got to get people there. You know, that's the thing. There's no That's not stopping the private enterprise people from trying, though. They've got Space Adventures working with the Russians still. They're the ones that do the flights to space station. Now they've got a moon project they're working on.
Yeah, I want to go and say Tranquility Base, it did happen. See, there it is. I'm leaning on it.
That's right.
I mean, you know that's going to be the money shot right there, you know? So
yeah,
So I'm you know, okay, everybody goes, well, I don't think we wag. You know what? I ain't worried about it because I know we're going to be able to tell, okay? So someday, here we go. All right. Well, you come across good, you know, I see it in your newsletter. I may be calling you directly, but what's the timeline on them landing first stage SpaceX on land?
He says it'll be mission after next, or possibly the one after that. So within the next three missions, they're going to try a landing on land. Yeah.
You mean before the end of the year, maybe?
It's possible. I don't know what the timeline is for the missions. So what are we now? In August, September? I mean, I think it's probably a little bit too early to say, you know, the end of this year, but possible by, you know, within a few months, I think.
Wow. I mean, I don't see how the media, they can, you know, keep that. Because I feel a lot of suppression in what is being accomplished in private space travel. I don't understand. This is when I was a kid. You know, this is, born in 61. So when was it? July 68, 69 was Apollo landing. You know, it
69,
was,
yeah.
Yeah. So I'm going, okay, so what was I, 8 years old or something? And that was, I mean, everything was space this, space that, every little itty bitty kind of media of everything in the middle of Vietnam, you know, everything. And then now it's like avoided. You know, kids in school, they don't know what the hell's going on. And I'm going, what is the purpose? And I'm wondering, it's going to be very interesting to see, like with the spaceship one, when it went up and almost a media blackout that was going on there. Of course, it was front page around the world, but not here. And I'm going, wow. So then when we have the first stage actually come back and do the Buck Rogers land thing, I'm wondering how they're going to keep that secret. And if they try.
Yeah. I think based on past experience, I don't think it's going to get much coverage. This private company got to the space station with cargo. I mean, that should have been front page news, but nope, they hardly got any press at all.
No, you know what the big press I get is you have all these CubeSats, you have all these Iridium. Now, remember me talking about it? I go, man, they're going to be doing Iridium, the satellite communication bay, and all of a sudden it's free text, you know, from the South Pole now. You know, we have Outer Net, you know, that's going on. They're starting to do that. Started, launched on my 30th wedding anniversary a week ago Monday, so I remember that. So I go, you know, this is, it's happening right now, and there's nothing. And I'm going, wow, this is a demonstration of wow. When they have the first stage rocket booster come and land, I'm wondering what's going to get the attention. When they bring an asteroid back, you know what's going to get the attention? When they actually land on Mars?
Yeah, I think it's going to have to be people. I think that's what it is. Spaceship One had people on it. So I think when they're flying people, I mean, this is my, of course, I've been saying this all the time. Okay, when they reach the space station, then it'll be big. Okay, when they land, you know, they've already soft-landed a booster on the water. That hardly got any attention. So I think the land one is not going to get much more. But when they start flying people, of course, now, you know, watch me eat my words. When they do, they'll be like, okay, well, it's just people going to the space station. You know, it's a NASA contract. There's nothing new about this, you know. But the good thing is we don't need that attention. They don't need that kind of, you know, media presence.
They just keep on
doing it.
Yeah,
you know?
See, that's kind of my point. Is to me, I'm going, all it does is demonstrate their mindset. If it doesn't support the collective, if it doesn't, you know, add to one more saluter to the flag, if it doesn't, you know, support that, you know, America versus kind of, if it doesn't do that, they have no interest in it. And I'm thinking that there's no interest in anything that the government or naysay does. I love that. Naysay is awesome. So I go, you know, I see that they're just going further and further in the rearview mirror, and that humanity marches on. And I'm looking for this representation of humanity. And that's another good question. Where is the overlapping of ethnicity of, I wouldn't even say governments, but I'm just like, is there the uber great gazillionaire from Australia working with the guy from the UK with the New Zealand kid and the 13-year-old from Brooklyn that came together to, you know, and we don't recognize any, you know, jurisdiction?
Yeah, I think it's just naturally moving that way. I mean, if more people have a global consciousness, and like you were talking to the guest before me about what's going on in, you know, Palestine and Israel, and people have this, you know, global connection, consciousness, they feel kinship with people across borders. I think there's just more and more of that going to be happening, and these other things will become less and less relevant, like what NASA's doing. I mean, NASA right now is an important function. It's a customer for SpaceX and other companies, even Spaceship 2 has NASA, you know, flying researchers on it, signed up.
Where
so that's
that?
The function.
Why are they doing that? Why is the government, so they can get their toe in, or they get some kind of disclosure, or they, I mean, why? What do they care?
It's for researchers, so it's called the Flight Opportunities Program. So if you're a researcher and you have some, you know, experiment you want to run on suborbital space flight, then you can apply to NASA for a grant, basically. And the grant is you get to, they'll buy you a space flight. So NASA becomes the customer, and it helps. It's just like running the mail, you know, in the 19-teens and the 20s, when the government was buying airmail contracts from people like Charles Lindbergh. He was an airmail pilot, and it helped get the aviation industry off the ground. So that's, I think that's an important function that government can serve, and they are serving sort of in spite of themselves and the other opposition.
Well, see, I'm wondering why that isn't opposed. I would think that the special interest of, you know, hell no, you know, they don't, or just they do a little bit over there to kind of justify their gazillion dollar boondoggle of how many billions of dollars. Yeah, but we funded this as just a PR thing, but then it bites them in the ass because somebody gave $50 to somebody to go up against their $50 billion, you know, and kick the ass with it.
That's a danger that's happened in the past where NASA has taken on somebody or some venture and it becomes their main customer or maybe their only customer, and then when they pull the plug, they're dead. So that's why it's so important that someone like SpaceX has contracts even from other government entities like the Air Force, and more importantly, I think, the commercial.
Well, are they allowed to even have other countries? You know, this is, you had the International Space Station. I didn't even look at it, don't care, because, you know, I've been covering all the CubeSat stuff, and all of a sudden we launched 30 satellites at one time, barely gets any news, and you have the outer net done, and it turns on and bite me, and it's like everybody's cell phone in a CubeSat with a solar panel, and all of a sudden I got my own satellite for nothing, okay? And then what's the big news? Soviet astronaut, cosmonaut from the space station let a CubeSat go. Look, with his little cube. I go, yeah, you're about a year too late.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, it's like the solar power stuff we were talking before. You know, it's happening. It's going to happen. And whether it gets the coverage or the support from government or other places or not, it's still going to happen. So I think I'm very hopeful about it. As a reporter working in that area, I'm more disappointed because there's not as many people paying me for writing these stories as I'd like, but it's still going to happen despite that.
Well, so, it used to be that, you know, someone in your position, there was a big market. I mean, it was created. It was part of, you know, just because it was cool. It seems like there's a suppression in the media for, nah, it's not that cool. We don't want to make it cool, or it's too, don't make it too cool, or it's not government supported cool, or something. I mean, what there's a, you would think that. Where's the other guy? Who's the other, you know, technology, space exploration, humanity marches on guy? Where is that?
Yeah, I know. It's space is hugely important, I think, but it gets lumped into all the other categories: brain science, ocean science, you know, cool gadgets on your you know, phone or desktop. And people say, well, we don't want to run too many space stories. Well, we just did a space story. I'm like that, and like you say, that wasn't the mentality in the '60s. Oh, well, there's lots of stuff going on in space. We better do lots of space stories, right? It's like, oh, they didn't say, oh, well, somebody already went into space last week, so we can't do another story on
that. No. When they did space.com, they first started that, and I think they had, God, wasn't it Walter what the hell is his name? The news anchor. Do you remember his name, the big news anchor they had? It's one of the big boys. I want to say Walter Cronkite, but it wasn't him. I mean, you know, it was along that level, okay? And when they did that, and he gets up there, and, oh, we're going to get some space coverage. Okay, we're going to have a network. We're going to have some regular. I mean, I don't need to be bombarded with, you know, just BS, CNN repeating the same crap all over. You know, but there's a lot of stories out there. And I'm going, okay, so let's go tell them then.
Oh, you're talking about Lou Dobbs?
Yeah, Lou Dobbs, okay?
Yeah.
So Lou Dobbs gets up and he starts doing this space.com. Okay, we might get some coverage. They're going to, and no. And they can't even get a Michael Before, that you have a diversity of all the other stuff that's going to go to space, robotics, you know, new technology, dealing with DARPA. I mean, I would think that Michael be the guy. How come you ain't the guy? What, did you piss off somebody?
No, I don't think so.
You don't have enough insider? You're not having martinis with Elon enough? I mean, come on. You see my point? I think there's something else going on.
Yeah. I don't know. It's easy to get discouraged, but at the same time, not. I mean, every time I do, I get discouraged, I go, well, they're still doing it, so it doesn't matter what I'm doing. It doesn't matter who's covering.
It's not, it's not discouragement. It's almost like it's an opportunistic look at it, going because they leave such a void for people like you and me and friends, because we have our own category. We cover this kind of stuff and everything. So I'm going, you know, okay. I mean, that's where Freedom's Phoenix came from. I go, all right, you want to leave this big, giant void of the perspective and covering of news that we feel is, you know, in technology and new and the generation next and this youth is taking over. You guys want to do that. And then you tell them, you wonder why you put all the cable news together. Together, and you're lucky to get, you know, what, 5 million people watching at 315 million? I go, and you're wondering why? Because you guys suck. That's why.
Well, I think it's more simple than that. I think most people lack the imagination, including the editors and, you know, producers and stuff of these outlets. They don't see the thing that we do, that this is inevitably going to become, you know,
no, it's worse than that.
The biggest.
They don't see because the incentive is for them not to see or only see what they want them to see or emphasize certain traits. Mm-hmm. I see this, man. I mean, that's why I do this. I see the trend. It is for, if it doesn't serve some kind of a nationalistic, patriotic, mind-numbing going in a certain, that's why they call it television programming, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I can see, I mean, all of a sudden it starts to make obvious sense. Yeah, I'm getting programmed to what? Is it? I tell you the one thing that they have to kill, and this is where you come in, is they have to kill Generation Next imagination. If they can take away the imagination, if you go to the grocery store where science fiction used to have its own freaking shelf and category, now it's not even there. It's like they've taken the imagination away, but because of the internet and because of just curiosity of 12-year-olds, you know, they're losing control. And people are starting to, you know, find things like yours. I'm just shocked that it took me. When did you publish Rocketeers? When did that come out?
2007, I think.
And I didn't even know about it until 10. You know, that's when we first had you on, and I'm going, oh, and it wasn't until I had you, I didn't even look at the copyright. I just assumed that it just, I would have known about it. How did I not know this? You know, are you freaking kidding me? So that's what I see. It's like a suppression, and it is. I'm convinced. You know, they don't, a lot of what we do and all the Lovelutionary stuff and us dealing around with the Generation Next, and I got my fifth grandkid just born. I got sixth one coming. You know they're going to, I'm inspired. I got a Saturn V rocket keychain that my grandson has to touch and play with all the time. And then it goes missing for a while. I find it again. Like, no. You know, then we go through the launches and we start going, then we show pictures. And I know that this is just, you know, the imagination as they just start kindergarten. They're going through. I can see they're not going to get it there. You know, then, of course, they're going to start influencing their friends and they're start bringing new models or show and tell or do it. We'll do everything we can to help do our part here. And the internet allows that. But I guarantee you the mandatory youth indoctrination camps of, you know, I pledge allegiance at 4 years old in kindergarten. They aren't telling them anything about what that pledge, that freedom has created. There's no the goal isn't to, you know, have a better life or a future. That's not their goal. Their goal is, you know, the pledge itself to this thing, and the only word they understand at 4 years old is maybe the word I. All the other stuff, what? You know, I'm going, and it pisses me off because there's the whole thing that I see the inspiration that you can get from a young mind just being inspired. And imagine us, you having access to a 3D printer at 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, anything that you could think or do and all this other stuff, I don't even want to try and draw. Just look, this is what's available. Here's a little CAD thing. Learn kind of pace. And you just step back and 5 years later, oh, my God. That's it.
Right.
You know, and that's the role that you, I just want to keep you inspired at how much I use what you're doing because, you know, one less thing I got to do, okay? And, you know, and it makes it easier. I'm glad I'm on your newsletter now. Please do not hesitate that when there's some co, make sure that I know, okay?
Okay, you got it.
Hey, keep up the good work, man. Good luck to you. You're going to be on the top of the list of a lot of this stuff. I'm going to be seeing you one of these days up there doing everything. You have your own show.
Shoot me a note to get Brian's contact info if you want it, and I'll hook you guys up.
Yeah, Donna, do that. Just send Michael a note. Please, we'd like to talk to Michael about, you know, his move from SpaceX to X-Corp. It's Brian. What's Brian's last name?
Brian Binney.
Binney. Brian Binney from Spaceship One. And then he went over to X-Corp doing the Lynx thing, and so we'd just like to talk to him about that. That'd be awesome. That'd be a good PR. Yeah, they should have him as the PR guy. Crap. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
hey, I'm sorry, what?
No, they don't have the PR machine that Virgin does.
Well, I'll pimp them. You know, I'll help. You know, I'm really interested in their engine. Because, see, I didn't know that they were the engine behind the Rocket Racing League. You know, this was the whole point of what they were doing that, was to have this, the space and back, refueling rapid same day thing, because that's another milestone. They launch Lynx up and it comes down, they do it again that day, within 24 hours, they win.
Yeah. Yeah, they don't toot their horn a lot, which is one of the reasons I'm excited about them, because they're more action than talk than some of the other people in this area.
Oh, before you go, on the Blue Origin, you know, what is there? See, the Blue Origin got my interest because they were probably the closest to the Buck Rogers, I got a ship, it takes off, it comes back, lands.
Yeah,
I mean, that's
right.
An old-fashioned kind of, that was, do they even have stages, or are they just doing it all in one vehicle?
As far as I know, it's all one, or actually, no, let me correct that. I think the crew compartment detaches and comes down separately, and so it's really technically a two-stage, although they're only using one to get up. But coming back down, it separates.
Well, are they going to save the first stage, or?
Yeah, reusable, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, but
so
it's suborbital.
Is there any information on Blue Origin? I mean, are they, because every time I go to their site, they don't really, share a lot.
No, they don't. They talk about no publicity. I mean, they just don't care at all about that. And in fact, they want to keep people away. So what news comes out tends to be when they're recruiting engineers, which they do a fair amount, so they reveal a little bit then. And also they have to file, this is a case where government regulation actually is a little bit helpful for people like us, because they have to file like environmental impact statements and things like that whenever they do a launch.
God.
And in the connection with that, they have to release some details about what they're doing. And then you can start to...
I know they're in West Texas. They got their own thing, and then you have SpaceX got their Texas thing. How far away are they?
You know, I don't actually know. It's a good question. I don't know how far apart they are.
Hmm. All right. One more thing you need to put on your list to go find out. Where are they?
Maybe I'll sneak over there. Somebody climb the fence or something.
Well, what's going on with Spaceport USA? I went a few years ago, 4th of July. I went there and talked to the... the guard, and kind of got some pictures and went around and saw, and I just got a big giant ooh, it's just a government thing.
Spaceport America?
Yeah.
In New Mexico?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's they intended for Virgin to be the anchor tenant. So they've got this big purpose built hangar and, lounge and stuff there. But Spaceship Two has been stalled for 10 years. I mean, no one thought it would take this long for them to actually start flying. So they're just kind of waiting for people to show up.
What's the UK has got some spaceport they're putting in too. What's up with that?
Yeah, actually, I don't know about that. I know there's one in Scotland. Is that the one? That I'm not too up on those.
It was
There's
just
not much going on. No one's flying yet, so it's mostly talk in terms of these kind of commercial spaceports.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, at least they're talking. But I, you know, I just assume I get my. See, that's one thing I like about the Texas deal, especially Texas probably makes it easier. You know, there's a lot of private land and everything. They go to Texas and they say, you know what? We got enough land and over there in Pace. Oh yeah, I forgot all about this. There was the. Was it Galveston? What was it? It's on the coast. They're on the Gulf of California. They're trying to get SpaceX. Wasn't it SpaceX are trying to get a launch facility there?
Yeah, they're doing SpaceX. Well, SpaceX is going to build a spaceport in Texas as well. And so then they'll have a development and test facility there and a spaceport separated. I mean, they're not next to each other, but that's going on. And X-Corps is moving to Texas, to Midland, Texas. It's a better regulatory environment.
Well, yeah, so it's a Republic of Kiss My Butt, you know. So I'm, and you're in California. I don't even know what the hell they're doing in California. Why? I don't even know why they even went there. You know, well, I guess it used to be the desert, but you know, now it's we rule you crap. You know, so Texas probably just, you know, yay, get your butt over here.
Mm-hmm.
All right, all right. Well, keep us informed. Yeah, there's see, there's so much we can go on for hours, but I'm. Yeah, let's go ahead and do you have a map out of this, you know, like another book on the way, or you got an article that kind of, you know, does the geography and the chronology of a lot of this stuff and development level of different things?
No, that's a good idea. No,
yeah. Yeah, that's a good idea. Michael, I think you should do that.
All right.
And when can I expect that? When are you going to get on that for me?
Yeah, I'll let you know.
Yes. You know, I wish to encourage that because, I mean, think about it. You know, the chronology from just the Rocketeer's book, I mean, where each one of these companies have been, what's the regulatory environment, where are they going, to get a little behind the scenes on, you know, Bezos' stuff, you know, some of the technological developments. Oh, my God, Elon's Iron Man, you know, Tony Stark 3D, I printed it crap right there is freaking two chapters, you know. Then, you know, I mean, seriously, you know, if you're not that busy, you got time to write a book. Get on it, man. That's Let me know.
All right. All right.
All right, buddy. Talk to you later, Michael.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.